Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
When that bass crashes in, you know it's time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to DLC. Especially if you were one of our geeks in sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Maybe you're in traffic. We're there too. We're going to be with you in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness. Actually, a lot more than 90 this week. I'll get to that shortly, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our sponsors this week, Robinhood, Cashfly, and Squarespace. Squarespace! They're bringing the show to you. DLC, of course, the show, all about games and their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis. The guy who joins me on this Thanksgiving week to give thanks to all of you for making this show possible. It's Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving week. Also, I want to say up front for the holidays, the Play Games Be Nice Popsicle Super Nintendo-esque controller tee is back available on Cotton Bureau. They're using a slightly different printing method. Should still be good quality, a little cheaper, and proceeds still go to St. Jude. So you can go to cottonbureau.com and search for Play Games Be Nice.
I got mine.
Get your shirt.
Looks sharp, dude. Looks sharp. I got it. It's not, you know, not the summer anymore, but you can still rock the popsicle dripping in the hot heat. Looks like a controller. Looks really sharp.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it is no longer the summer, but kids still need help battling cancer. So I decided to put it back up, and I said, let's do it.
That's fantastic. We got a lot to talk about. As I said, we're thankful for you guys being here. We've got a lot to be thankful for. This is going to be, you've probably already noticed, if you noticed your pod catcher of choice downloading this episode. It's going to be a long one because we have some bonus content at the end of the show. My friend and my co-host on the Slash Filmcast, Dave Chen, asked if he could
friend slash co-host slash good friend?
I already did a joke like that in the bonus content that we already recorded. But it's okay. It'll be like an hour and a half from now. People won't even remember. he wanted to get some stuff off his chest with regard to Red Dead Redemption 2. So we recorded what I thought was going to be a 20-minute discussion. It turned into a 50-minute discussion. So that's going to be at the end of this episode. So also I should note that at the beginning of that conversation, we say spoilers for Red Dead Redemption 2 and then don't get to spoilers for like 35 minutes. So if you haven't finished Red Dead and you don't want to be spoiled, you can actually still listen to a good portion of what we talk about, because that's how that goes. Anyway, lots to look forward to in this episode, but we have tons even before that, because we've got tons of games to talk about. You think this time of the year isn't full of news? Wrong. We got huge news to talk about, and we have an awesome guest to do it with. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian, but this week I'm so excited because DLC stands for Decidedly Large Comedy, because we have writer, comedian, and certifiably tall person Brock Wilbur joining us for the first time. Hey, Brock.
Hey, gentlemen. How we doing?
Doing well, man. I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm a big fan of you. You're one of my favorite comedians, one of my favorite people, one of my favorite Twitter streams to read. So I'm so excited to have you on the show.
If I can do just a brief 10 seconds of sincerity before I become who I am. Glad that you're okay, bud. Watching your Twitter feed this week with the fire and stuff, and everyone else in LA, but like, especially some of your stuff was pretty harrowing. I was just like, God, I really hope Jeff's okay and the family's okay. It's nice to see that you're in a good place.
Well, thank you for saying that. I should note that because I did talk about it last week, and we're very, very fortunate. We were never in any physical danger, and you know, it was scary. It was anxiety inducing, but we are very fortunate. A lot of people, a lot less fortunate than we, and deserve continued support. If you're able to, there are lots of deserving charities. Lots of people lost their homes very near me. Lots of my friends, people I know, still haven't been able to get to homes, even homes that weren't destroyed. Several friends have homes that were destroyed. It's been a harrowing time, but I appreciate you saying that. My family and I were scared, but my goodness, are we fortunate. And I'm very grateful for that.
I don't know how we go from the sincerity and genuine humanness of that to being like, can you believe what Cliffy B said this week?
Oh my God. Well, you know, the thing we can rely on is a catchy jingle.
Story of the week. It's the story of the week. Story of the week. It's the story of the week.
Story of the week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happen in the world of games this week. And you can always submit stories for our consideration by visiting our subreddit. That's 5x5dlc.reddit.com. And wow, an interesting week, a really fascinating week that has a lot of ramifications for the gaming industry as a whole. Brock, you are our guest. You get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Boy, howdy. I think that we should probably dive right into all the nominations for the Game Awards, which seems to just keep spiraling wildly out of control.
Indeed. That's a good one way of putting it. Game Awards, I think, have positions themselves, and I think the industry has embraced that, as being sort of the premier front-facing populist gaming awards. You know, there's a lot of the GDC awards and a lot of prestigious sort of professionals awarding themselves. But this, I think, Jeff Keighley has positioned it as very much a premier audience-facing awards ceremony, full of lots of reveals. And we got the nominations this week. Lots of stuff to dive into with categories and such. I'll just briefly mention the Game of the Year, the big, the big top-tier category, Game of the Year. This year's nominees are Assassin's Creed Odyssey, Celeste, God of War, Spider-Man, Monster Hunter World, and Red Dead Redemption 2. So, Brock, what do you think of these? What do you think of the awards as a whole? What's your feeling about all of this stuff?
I bring the same level of seriousness to this awards as I do to most award shows, which is you can't see the hand gesture I'm doing, but it's fine. It's fine. And it's nice. It is nice to recognize achievements and things. And I think that some of the European awards lately have done like a really good job of doing that. And maybe my biggest disappointment here is that the Games for Impact just seems to be a category for like, if you have gay characters, throw them in there and they can't be anywhere else, which I was like, well, that's not great. There's so much this year, and there's so many things that like these genres don't really break down, which is always my first place to start in a problem with award show. Like, for example, and I keep thinking about this, and either I love this or I hate this. There is a category for best ongoing game, which right. seems relevant now because we have games that have no end point. So it's Destiny 2, Fortnite, No Man's Sky, Overwatch, and Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Siege. So some of those games have a lot more content than others do, and some of those venture into like, well, if it's full on esport at this point, like, of course it has to be that way, but also like how much of No Man's Sky is a never ending game. And like, it is also weird that like Destiny 2, which is the second entry in a series doing that thing, is up against Fortnite, a game that came out and is just still out, but that is the category. It is a category that needs to be deconstructed to explain what you're even trying to do, but it's an award show. So do whatever, just throw them all in there, give somebody an award, move on to the next thing. The rest of it is that just simply like, I am not an esports guy. So like the second half of the list is all various types of like esport teams and presenters. So I'm like, I can't weigh in there. So it looks fine to me.
Well, I would go even farther. You pointed out best ongoing game it being kind of hard to, a little inscrutable. I think the whole structure of these awards is archaic and weird and doesn't make much sense. Best ongoing game is a great example. Like, what, you know, you say, what are the criteria of that? Is it a game that did really great this year in introducing new content, or is it just the best game that's still hanging around? Or, you know, what does that even mean? I would go farther and say there's a category for best action game. Is there a video game that doesn't have action? Like, what is a, what does best action game mean? And then there's another category of best action adventure game. So the games that only have action and don't have adventure, but best action game is Far Cry 5. No adventure in that game? There's just an action game without adventure? But best action adventure
game. Visual novel category, like, to combat all of this, at least pick some things on the other ends of the spectrum. Which, and like, we've seen this in the Oscars this year, they went back and forth about whether or not they're including a category for, like, audience favorite at this point, because award shows know that people want to see the things that they like get awards. And, like, I don't know, maybe there's a lot of things that we can borrow from the Oscars. Maybe we shouldn't borrow that. But also, like, where's the category in the Game Awards for best costumes? You know, let's do some period yeah. piece awards for games so that Assassin's Creed can win something every year.
Yeah, yeah. And best role-playing game. So Monster Hunter World is a role-playing game, but Assassin's Creed Odyssey isn't? All of this stuff, I think you make a great point, Brock, in saying it's an award show. It's just for fun anyway. It doesn't – it's not, you know, curing cancer. It's just for fun. Who cares? It's kind of shrug your shoulders and go, But also, if you want to position this as being – you know, meaningful in any way, I think these categories need to be rethought and really what even is any of this? I think it's trying to create itself in the image of the Oscars. And I think that's laudable, but I think this industry is different enough that you kind of need a different template. And Christian, I'm curious what you think about this. And if you think that there's a solution, my proposal might be to break things down by size of team and or budget. I know movies don't do that. I know you can have a very small independent movie that's nominated for Best Picture against a giant movie like Titanic or something. But
I do want to live in your world where the team that made Tangerine on like an iPhone gets to have their own category. I really do appreciate that. And I like that idea.
Right. Well, I mean, I think maybe that might be useful and to say, hey, let all these big multi-million dollar, you know, $100 million games fight it out, and then let game. I mean, I guess that's what the independent category kind of is, but I don't know. Christian, what do you think?
I mean, I've spoken at length about the Game Awards before. I think to me, the jump out thing on this list is favorite moment of 2017, and it's just things that happened at last year's Game Awards.
Oh my God, yeah. I hadn't even looked at this yet. Oh my God.
So it's like you win an award for winning an award last year. Like I really like Jeff. I really like at the times I've hung out with him and talked with him and we've laughed.
He's been on the show. He's been very kind to be here on the show. He's a friend of the show.
He's a friend of the show. And he puts video games in a spotlight that a lot of other people can't do anymore. A story we'll get to in a moment, I think. And he's made this a premier event where it's about the debuts. And I think that these awards are, as you and Brock mentioned, Jeff, a kind of a vestige of holding on to of like, we want to be this serious thing and mimic the Oscars in some way. And I almost think they've had some missteps before with like the Schick Razor mascot and stuff like that. But I think if they embraced a more fun route and not sell out everything sponsored route, but a more fun, we're here to celebrate all things gaming. This is going to be a party. We're going to have a great time and lean into some of those industry connections and the reporting that Jeff has done over the years and make it like a really cool, like those, the Half-Life 2, those retrospectives he did where like those virtual magazines and stuff that Jeff put together.
They did some of that.
And they I did some of that.
Last year. Yeah.
Yes, they did. And that could win one of the favorite moments of 2017. But I think if it was more that, Like, imagine, I picture it leaning more like the ESPYs and less like the Oscars, where the ESPYs, they're the ESPYs, right? They're not, it's not MTV Movie Awards amount of silliness, but it's some silly categories or some things that are a little outrageous, but also they really take moments to celebrate icons of sport, and they do so in a heartfelt way. And while the ESPYs, I don't think anyone, any athlete is like, yes, I got my ESPY, I did. Like, you know, they're not vying for an ESPY the way college football players vie for a Heisman or professional players want to win an MVP. But it's an award show that walks that balance really well. And I don't think the Game Awards has found it.
What this list has is that, like, there's all this stuff that acknowledges last year's thing. And the thing that you're bringing up, they actually did do in sort of that, like, 5-minute documentary about the history of, like, Westwood Studios and Command and Conquer and stuff, which was really cool. But also, like, I'm trying to think back as to the things that I remember each year of this. And, like, my number one, like, Game Awards memory of all time is, like, 2010 when they did a teaser trailer for Del Toro's game Insane that was supposed to be published by Volition. And it's just, like, a screw going through the logo that says Insane. And then nothing ever came from that game because it definitely just lived as a pitch in a Word document somewhere, and that was the end of it. But, like, yeah. in my memory, that's important and cool. And, like, if you're going to put up the events of this, like, just go ahead and acknowledge that, like, the trailers are what this event show exists for. And the more categories we have, the more trailers we get to see, ostensibly. Maybe that's okay.
You're so right. I mean, honestly, that's really – it is a trailer show – with some awards to pad it out. Really, that's what it is. But, you know, again, I don't want to be super cynical about it. I'd love to get, you know, just in the Game of the Year category, or whatever category you want. What do you guys think? Do you think it's a good representation of the year? I mean, Christian, you must be thrilled that Celeste made, you know, the top, what, six here for Game of the Year. I think that's pretty big accomplishment for that small game.
I really like Celeste. The fact that it was nominated, or any game that I love is nominated or not nominated for the Game Awards, means nothing to me.
Okay. All right. I can't pry any positive words about this out of anybody.
That's fine. So dark.
I have my list of games that I love, and I love a lot of these games, but it's not... Oh, here's what I'll say, Jeff. Hopefully some of these games getting this recognition in any of these categories will encourage someone who is otherwise not going to check it out to check it out, and if hopefully love it as much as I did. That's what's great about this, is that it can hopefully expose the game to a new audience. So I love seeing all of the games that I love being listed here, so hopefully other people will check them out and have the similar experience that I had with them and fall in love with these games.
Cool. All right. Moving on. Christian, what is
one second right before we leave that?
Oh, sure.
I just love to, and I promise I care much less about everything else we talk about tonight. Christian had an excellent point, which is that, like, maybe this should acknowledge actual journalism that's occurred in the year and some of the things like that. And, like, I really, if there was a category up here that had, like, you know, the people that spent, like, a year doing an oral history of a game, or say the journalist that broke the Riot Games story that has become the overarching, like, big story of the games industry in the last couple of months and continues forward, like, that would seem like a thing that somebody that is a games journalist would want to acknowledge in the show that they put together. And I know that beyond that, all the nominations would have to be like, here's to Greg for his piece about when the streamer was racist, and then there'd just be a whole bunch of those. Might be less serving to the games community, but, like, that does seem like something that belongs here.
I think that's a great point. And, you know, if maybe Jeff kind of felt the responsibility to use the awards to spotlight things. I mean, because when Red Dead Redemption 2 inevitably wins this, and, you know, I kind of feel like anybody that's nominated for Content Creator of the Year who isn't named Ninja is just like, sorry, guys, sorry, gals, it's not, you know, it's not your year. But more power to him. It tends to be a fairly interesting ceremony that has some cool reveals. So, you know, it's fine. All right, Christian, what is your story of the week?
E3 is dead. Long live E3. Sony officially announced that it is not going to be involved in E3 in any form or fashion. They said they are not going to have a sideshow or kind of do a, you know, proxy event. They're not going to do a press conference of any kind. They're not going to be on the show floor, nor are they going to be in proximity to the event a la EA or Microsoft. This is the first time in 24 years. And Jeff, I was next to you when we found this out. I think it was 5 minutes after Sony announced this, I got an email from E3 that was like, best E3 ever coming up,
yeah.
Which they got that press release out quick. I mean, this was a, I think we all kind of saw E3's importance on a downward trend, but this still felt like a, you know, a head spinning moment of like, oh dang, they did it.
You guys are much better connected than me, but like, am I wrong here? Was there like a rumor of this a few months ago?
I hadn't heard any rumors that Sony was pulling out. Maybe I just missed it, but I hadn't heard that specifically. We've seen, as Christian pointed out, the slow death march of E3 as all these companies, you know, announced that they're not doing the show and that they're, you know, Microsoft did a show right next door. EA for 2 years now has done a show in Hollywood instead of downtown Los Angeles. But I think this is a completely different flavor of abandonment. this is not, hey, we acknowledge that E3 is still happening, we're just not going to be part of the official show, but it's still a big week and we're still going to, you know, Nintendo, yeah, we're not going to have a traditional press conference, but we're still going to have a big Nintendo Direct. And this is like, we're ghosting. it remains to be seen exactly what they do, but their messaging around this is, we're not doing anything. This week is dead to us. This, like, we're not making any kind of big deal about June in any way. And that to me feels like a completely different kind of thing. And
give,
as Christian also
Sony mentioned, morning to Devolver Digital, you cowards.
Yeah, right. Right. And, you know, a lot of people have made a lot of guesses as to what this is about. I think, as we see more and more companies, you know, want to disintermediate their message, they want to be the owners of their messaging. And Nintendo has done a very, very good job of, we don't need press conferences. We literally would just put a video out because we got 47 new Smash Brothers things to tell you. It doesn't have to be a comprehensive press conference. We just want to tell you about this one particular game. We have an Octopath Traveler thing. We just want to mention it. So we'll schedule a thing on Tuesday and you show up. You don't have to show up. It's an online situation. It's completely bypassing any kind of, you know, news media or person to propagate the message. You just talk directly to your audience. And I think that's what we're going to see. There's no need for E3.
And it's not millions of dollars to have the people that are going to spread your message stand uncomfortably in a makeshift church and be like, what? Oh, I'm so uncomfortable. This is awful. This, like,
I do feel a little guilty about, like, did I contribute
Jeff killed E3. Yeah.
Did I contribute to the death of E3? I mean, all of us, I'm sure Sony, like, they spent a fortune on that crazy event. And then somebody in a meeting afterwards went, why are we even doing this, guys? We just pissed a bunch of people off and they were sad. Why even do it? And I think that may, you know, maybe the last domino or straw or whatever
well,
the metaphor
because
is.
When you put on an event, and for a time it was part of it, right? And it would help games get buzz, is the presentation and the discussion. But I think over the years you've seen more people talk about the event and the presentation and the spectacle than necessarily what was presented. And I think last year's Sony press conference was a great example of that. And Ubisoft certainly struggled with that in years past too, where it was like, what was their gamer dude, Mr. Extreme or whatever?
No, you're right. Everybody puts out like theater reviews. You know, everybody's a critic of their theatrical presentation rather than, you know, the substance of what's even going on. And maybe that's fine. Like, it's a big spectacle and so be it. But I mean, I guess maybe the more pertinent question that we should ask instead of why is, what now? I mean, Brock, do you think that it's a loss for the industry not to have if this indeed means that there won't be a big week in early summer that all the games get announced for the next couple of years, and it turns into something more like what the gadget industry is, where each company has their own thing at some weird time during the year and that company gets all the spot. You know, Samsung has an event and they announce all their things for the year, and Apple has an event. It's, you know, months apart. Is that better, do you think, or do we lose something?
I kind of like this, where like everyone just sort of secedes E3 to Microsoft. I think it was 2 years ago. Was it the one where they started having us have like the light up bracelets at the event, and then those would change colors?
Right.
Throughout the event.
But even Microsoft wasn't there. They were adjacent. They had their own theater, and like they weren't even on the E3 floor.
Right,
they were just sort
of there. And then like other people that had like Ubisoft has their own thing and so on and so forth. And like this year covering it, I was like, oh, I have a spreadsheet of when everyone goes up. It's not like these three clean mornings anymore. And right. I joked about it before, but like Devolver Digital and like Adult Swim Games, like they do the most interesting presentations, and they can do those from anywhere. And like you mentioned, Nintendo could just take over everybody's Switch in the world at the same time and broadcast. Like, check it out.
Right.
It's negative Kirby, NECA Kirby. Get hype.
Wait, are those real announcements, Brock? Hold on. Do we get some exclusives?
Exclusives. Gotta get those exclusives.
I like it, and I like the idea of everyone throw your own thing, because why not? And if this eventually becomes just like a completely indie event, that would be more interesting. But like also they made their bed to sleep in here when they were just like, oh, what if we just charge normal people an outrageous amount of money to come in and be on the floor? And then the floor became a nightmare hellscape for everybody else. The last couple of years have been unpleasant at best. Like, you guys are all there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a part of me that would mourn the loss of, you know, video game Christmas week, which is E3 just having it all concentrated and it all building up to this cool crescendo and the press conferences back to back and who won E3 and all that stuff. But it doesn't really serve anybody. It doesn't really help to go, did Microsoft beat Sony for E3? If you have Microsoft announcing stuff in May and Sony announcing stuff in August, then nobody's going, who had the better press conference? It's just, oh, the products. Let's talk about them.
But I need the corporations to fight. My identity depends on it. You guys.
Right. You make a solid point.
And I did. I am of that toxic background. The last time I saw Jeff, I believe I saw you when we were doing the Uncharted test session in like a thing that was made up to look like the jungle.
Yes.
And that was literally the first time I've ever held a PlayStation controller, because I've been an Xbox ride or die guy my entire life. And so like the person that was monitoring me doing my 30-minute test session just saw me kept throwing my main character against a wall that I couldn't climb and dying repeatedly. And at like the 20-minute mark out of the 30 minutes I was given, I was like, I've seen the game and I am finished here. Have a wonderful day. And they're like, you get more time and you can interview people. I was like, I'm good. I'm good here. Thank you, Sony.
Here's a positive take on this, Jeff. Mm-hmm. It's something that you and I have talked about a lot on this show, that while it would be a shame to see video game week go away, and I think Sony's calendars now go like March, April, May, July, you know, this June is dead. But hopefully this means announcing things when they're ready, and not needing to put together things for E3. Because I feel like Sony's E3 this year might be the exact same as it was last year, just minus God of War. Because I don't know when those games are coming out that they showed at that press conference last year, right? Like Ghosts, Last of Us 2,
Death Stranding.
Yeah. But so maybe we'll get more of the Bethesda Fallout 4 model, and things, they'll have a big press conference when they're ready to talk about something, when they have something to show, and not rushing out something that lets people look at puddles 6 months later when the game comes out.
Yeah, I didn't think that's a fair point. I also think that there may be something to what Nintendo is starting to do also, where you literally don't – you announce and show and get hype for one thing. Like, you don't have to have this wall-to-wall showing. – And I guess that works better for platform holders to say, oh, look, all this stuff that's coming out on your platform, buy this platform. But maybe it's cool to just have a thing about one game, you know, have a thing. And then a couple of weeks later, have a thing about another game. I don't know. Maybe that's a more digestible way to create excitement for your games. I don't know. It's a crazy moment that I think we all saw coming at some point, but to have it actually arrive feels still a little shocking, even if it was obvious it's going to happen.
Microsoft and Nintendo soaked their arm in the bathtub before taking off their Band-Aid. Sony was just like, rip. They just, yeah. I mean, there was no, just, we're done. This sucks. I hate you. Throw a match.
I've also seen a lot of speculation online, and I think several people tweeted me asking me if they thought, or if I thought that this was just because Sony didn't have anything to announce for the year. And I really don't think that's what it is. I think this is a bigger decision than just, we'll skip it this time. It feels like it really is a paradigm shift for how we are going to market our games from now on. And I would suspect that Sony has plenty of things that they could fill an E3 conference with. They're a very big company with a lot of first parties and a lot of very big games still on the horizon. So I don't think that's what it is at all. And I don't think this is the kind of thing where Sony next year goes, we're back to E3 because we have the PS5 to talk about. I think this is the kind of thing where we're going to have a PS5 event and we all get weird Apple-like invitations that have, you know, cryptic, like Apple does. You know, we're having a thing in September. It has bubbles on it. That could only mean one thing. You know, it's like, that's what I think that's what it's going to turn into.
I think it could have started as that, or someone was like, hey, what are we going to show at E3 this year? And then someone was like, what if we don't do E3 this year? And everybody laughed. Like, oh, okay, Sarah. Wait a minute. What
Sarah's
if we don't
point.
Do it? Yeah. And then they didn't do it.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting. I think it's going to be interesting. I for one, I don't think this year's E3 will be, you know, this will be no E3 this year or anything like that. I think E3 will still be worth covering and will be a big deal. But maybe next year, everybody will be like, we're not doing it. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Okay, my story of the week is a rumor. But I think juicy enough and coming from a source respectable enough that it deserves discussion. And it makes me very curious about what you guys think as far as what it means. We have a rumor coming from Thrott, which is a very reputable Microsoft covering tech industry site. And they have been right about things in the past. They are reporting that a new SKU for the Xbox One will cost $100 less than the current $299 base price, so $199, and it will be an Xbox One without a disk drive. So no disk for the Xbox One. This seems to line up with where Microsoft has been heading with regards to Game Pass being their, you know, front and center idea of, hey, buy your games digitally, subscribe to our service, download stuff. It's always available to you. It's the Netflix of video games. And with the idea of this next version of the Xbox, Scarlet, codenamed Scarlet, that will be basically a dummy box, a small little box that like a Roku or something
or
similar.
Or a version of it will be that. Microsoft
right. There will still be
saying, we're doing the other one too.
Correct. Yeah. But this all seems to be of a trend, right? Some details before I throw it to you guys. There will evidently be a program that allows you to get credit for games you own on disc, and that you will be able to go into a retailer, calling it disc to digital, where you'll be able to go into a retailer, hand them your physical copy, and they will give you a download code that lets you download it digitally. So if you want to have this, you want to replace your Xbox One with a disc drive, with one without a disc drive, they will all the games that you have on disc, they will still allow you to own, which seems like a cumbersome but necessary step. So this means that they're saying it's coming in 2019. This means that whatever Xbox Scarlet is probably won't come until 2020, but we already suspected that. Brock, what do you think? Discless? Is this the future? Is this half step worthwhile in order to kind of drive down the entry level price of the Xbox One?
I would be so shocked about this if I hadn't bought 4 years worth of Mac products that don't have a disk drive.
Right.
And this is what they want to do. They want you to subscribe to the membership model. That's clearly where the money is going forward. And it's a much better deal for consumers. Like, signing up for the Xbox Games Pass, especially like if you're the sort of person that like, I wasn't this person until a year or so ago when I got a PlayStation 4 and like was like, oh crap, I need a whole catalog of games on a sign up for their subscription service. Right now, doing that sort of thing, especially if you're in a 2 or 3 system household or your PC and you want a console, that's a great way to have access to a bunch of stuff that you want anyway without having to buy it at full price. And like Netflix, sometimes some of those things are going to disappear and you'll be like, ah, darn it. But the other side of that is that you already have Xbox Live Gold and those things come up on deals for like $4, $3 anyway. The number of things that I owned on physical like CDs and sold back to GameStop and have recently repurchased via like the Xbox Game Store for like $3 or $4 is like nearly every game I ever played on an Xbox console. So like this seems like I don't think I've put a disc into my Xbox One X since I purchased it like 6 months ago. So this doesn't seem like a leap and it sounds like a pretty good idea. And I kind of wish I'd waited for this.
Yeah. My Blu-ray of Mission Impossible 5, I think, is still in my Xbox because I watched it like 3 months ago before the movie came out. And there's been no reason for me to take the disc out because I don't use discs anymore. So, yeah. Christian, there is one reading of this that says it really reinforces, supports, and confirms all the things you've been saying. I prefer a different reading, which is that it refutes what you've been saying because it means it's pushing – it's a stopgap to what you think is the actual future. And if they need to do this as a stopgap, it means the actual console, Scarlett, is farther off than we think, right?
I don't know. I think they see money in it. I think they're not looking to rush Scarlett to market per se. I think these boxes, I still believe that these discless Xbox Ones could be turned into Scarlett's, the streaming version of Scarlett's. I think that's still a very real possibility. But I think Brock's point was a great one. I mean, my most powerful gaming machine, and I would probably argue yours too, Jeff, like doesn't have a disc drive. My gaming PC, I did not put a disc drive in it when I built it.
Mine has one.
Oh, lame. No. Well, let's edit that out. So Jess also doesn't have one. So I understand the move. Yeah, my Apple TV doesn't have a disc drive in it, you know. The thing that makes me sad about it is that as an honest to God, several year, probably too long, 10 years, I don't know, Gamefly member, subscriber.
Oh my God, really?
That's value. That's why I play a lot of my games. I mean, it takes work. I have to manage my queue, but things like I imagine not a lot of people, Gamefly is not huge, right? Like people use it and like it, but it's not the biggest company in the world. But I think things like that, I hope they do work out some form of game sharing. And Steam has experimented with it. Microsoft, I think on Xbox in other countries, experimented with it. Oh, and going back to our prior conversation, the only thing that makes me sad about Sony pulling out of E3 is Sony had some of the best E3 moments. The PlayStation price announcement, the sick burn to Microsoft on how you share games on PlayStation 4.
Yes.
Some unintentional burns of get a second job for the PlayStation 3. Anyway, I didn't need to go backwards. But that aspect of it does make me sad. I know like Steam, you can family share with like 10 accounts, wink, wink, families. But I do still think there's value in loaning someone a game. I have Mega Man 11 on a cart and I brought it in to work and said, hey, play it, take it on the plane, you know, take it, bring it on your Switch and you play it. And I hope that our all digital future finds some solution there. But otherwise, I'm totally on board. I would like to figure out digital rights sharing. You know, that easy problem of digital rights sharing.
Yeah. I mean, it murders stuff like Gamefly. I mean, Gamefly is a sponsor of our show. So that take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. But it feels like that's a rough go for them. And also lots of brick and mortar. You know, we've been talking about this for easily 10 years about the death of brick and mortar with regard to video game. But I wonder what places like, you know, GameStop are thinking with this stuff coming down the pike. They got to be worried, I think.
Yeah, there's no way that they're part of that disc to digital program. It's got to be Microsoft maybe stores, they are. Right?
Maybe like, yeah, guys, you'll still be in business. Let people come in and give them your old games, and you'll just give them this code, and then you can resell those games. It'll be great.
No way. No way.
Okay, well, I got to take a second and thank, speaking of sponsors, thank our first sponsor, Squarespace. You've heard me talk about Squarespace because I love it. I've been talking about Squarespace my entire podcasting career. They have supported me and my shows for forever, and I'm so grateful, mostly because I genuinely love their service. I use it. I recommend it to friends and family. What is it? Squarespace is the way to create a website, and a lot of people are intimidated by that. You should not be. Squarespace is so easy to use. You can create, you can turn a cool idea you have into a new website. You can showcase your work. You can blog or publish content. You can even sell products and services so easily using Squarespace, because all of it is what you see is what you get. Drag and drop. The tools are simple and intuitive and easy to use. You don't have to have any kind of programming experience. You don't even have to have any design experience, because you start with beautiful templates that they provide, and then you make them your own so that it doesn't look like every other website. So simply, so easily, just moving stuff around, getting it how you look. Well, like, they have built-in search engine optimization. They have analytics to help you grow in real time, free and secure hosting, and there's never anything to upgrade or patch. It's all handled for you in the background. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. This is just the way to do it. It's the easiest, best way to do it. Make it yourself. You don't have to pay someone. It's very expensive to pay someone to design a website. You can make it yourself. And in fact, you can make a website on Squarespace so simply and easily without even putting a credit card in. You just use the tools, get it to how you like it, and then you pay. And at that point, you go, well, at the beginning, you go to squarespace.com/Jeff sent me. You get your free trial. And then when you're ready to launch, you use the offer code Jeff sent me, JeffSentme, and save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Let them know that you heard about it here. Let them know it's been a good idea to support DLC. Squarespace.com/Jeff sent me, promo code Jeff sent me. Time to talk about the games we have been playing, and oh my goodness, are there a lot. This is going to be a fun segment. Let's jump right in with Brock. I want to talk about Fallout 76. Fallout 76, one of the big games released this week. Brock mad.
Brock fine.
Brock fine. Well, this seems like one of those games that people either have embraced and totally love and love it for its faults, not even despite its faults, kind of enjoy its faults in a weird way, or they hate it and still are forcing themselves to play it for some reason. That's a lot of people I've read that are just forcing themselves to continue playing it, even though they complain the entire time. What is your take on Fallout 76?
I was kind of hoping to put this on the back burner for like 2 weeks, come back after Thanksgiving. But then you invited me to come do your very popular show. And I was like, well, I can't not do it this week. So I fired it up. And here is the impression that I have. And like, my God, I love Fallout so much. And there is also still so much Fallout I need to play in other places. So what I like about Fallout 76 is that I went from character creation screen to like full on being in the game doing raids with people in about 20 minutes. It's the fastest possible Fallout that has ever existed. And it's because there's no NPCs, there's no dialogue, there's nothing really to do besides get involved in this. The other side of this is that, like, take everything I have to say with a grain of salt, because I don't like Borderlands. Borderlands never clicked with me. I don't like that kind of online co-op thing. But the more of this I play, the more I like it, and the more that I wish that I could just have a private server where I could just do my thing.
You just want some sort of single player Fallout game without other people and maybe more story and NPCs. Is that what you're saying?
They'll never make that. That game will never exist.
What I would actually like is this game, where instead of three random people, just assign me like three bots. Do it Left 4 Dead style, where some of them help and some of them are just awfully programmed and they just cannot help me at all, and it's funny how bad they are. But like, give me the space, because I love this world. I love the I love a Fallout that takes place in a world that isn't just gray, and like there is some life to this. And if you are a big Fallout fan, please check out the gigantic mod Cascadia, which is in progress right now and is sort of coming out very soon. It's set in the Pacific Northwest in like the Seattle area, and it's sort of like based around this like snow sort of thing, but also it was also based on an idea that they've been working on for a couple of years about like a world that is slowly like coming back to life. And I was like, oh, I kind of want that more than this. It's fine. And this is a sentiment I've seen replicated elsewhere. It's not my original idea. Mike Drucker and a million other people have done better than me, but this game feels like it is a game made in the post-apocalypse. It feels like it is held together with duct tape and like dead batteries and like old war money. Like it's just all strapped together. And I was like, here's this thing. And there is something about that that is genuinely, despite it being a billion-dollar AAA title, kind of scrappy. And that's what keeps bringing me back to it. I was like, I think that this is the most broken game I've played in many years. But everyone else is stuck in it too, which I kind of like. It's like we're all masochists here. And like, let's just see, can we get to the heart of Mordor or to where the programming just breaks down? It is an ostensibly bad game that I keep having very fun experiences within. And that has challenged my evaluation of it, because I keep being like, I hated all that. And then I'll like tell my wife about like this ridiculous thing that happened. And like the first person I met in this world, their call sign was Donkass79 or something like very close to that. And I was just like, oh, good. It's me and Donkass79 out here. And then I immediately got killed. And the first thing that happens when you get killed is that you can like cry out for help and you have like 30 seconds for somebody to come. And the only person in the area was Donkass79. Of course, Donkass79 didn't help me. And I was like, what a Donkass79 move for you to make.
It's classic Donkass is what it is. Classic Donkass79.
Classic Donkass move right there. And I was like, okay, so that's what kind of Fallout this will be. Because I don't do multiplayer. I don't do that stuff with people. Like, I hate it. But I kind of like that there's this area of effect multiplayer challenge here, where it's like the very first thing I fell into was like, oh, you're in a town and like there's these farm bots and they're on the fritz and you've got to kill three of them in under 30 minutes. And if anybody else is in your area, they should help you kill them or whatever. They get points for that. I was level one. Everyone else was level nine. They just left me alone there and I died a bunch. I can see where it's supposed to work. It doesn't work for me and I don't like it or enjoy it, but I keep coming back. And here is the thing that I think that the two of you are probably going to agree with me on. It is very difficult to be a man in your 30s playing an always online multiplayer video game that does not have the ability to pause, not just because like I can't even read something without something attacking me and killing me, but also if I just like tell my character to play the banjo and walk away to like grab a new beer, by the time I come back, my character has dehydrated and died. Like there's too many ticking clocks and spinning plates. And I'm just like, oh, just let me hit the pause button right. And have a life for a second. My cat has to go to the vet. I'm sorry. It's the wrong week for me to play Fallout.
Man. A brilliant summation of the game. I don't even want to add anything to that, but I will. The idea that somehow Bethesda Studios is this like massively successful $1 billion company, maybe, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, and yet somehow straddles the line and pulls off this feeling of like, hey, when we release Jank, it's charming. I don't know how they do it, but they've done it over and over and over again. And people somehow embrace this game series and their productions Jank when, you know, you have numerous other games that get flamed and torched. And I guess there's a fair amount of flaming and torching of Bethesda products. I won't say there isn't, but somehow the fans will just find it charming. I think that's there's some magic there that they possess that nobody else seems to. And also,
this actually ties back into the thing that we were talking about earlier, which is that, like, this year I was covering the E3 streams for everything, for Rock, Paper, Shotgun, and I had to cover it all day, every day. My wife has never watched E3 before, and I had to explain why people like Todd Howard, who can't speak to humans, were going up on the stage, and it was like, here's fireworks, and everyone was cheering, and then, like, the most milquetoast white dude you've ever seen was like, hi, I like things. And then everyone was like, good. And then it was like, okay, bye. And like, there's that. And then I had to, like, she loves Fallout 3, but I had to show her, like, hey, did you know that Bethesda sent us all a letter ahead of this saying, you guys, this game, it gonna be bad. Such bad game. So much bad in this game. We did not. They're bugs.
Yeah.
So much bug. You go out, you see, you come back and tell us, it not great. It's fine. That's what we ship. Good night, bye.
Yeah. Yeah. We should definitely not be releasing this.
We get to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be unconscionable for us to charge money for this. Anyway, here's a $99 edition where you get a different hat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally true. And, you know, and it's a crazy thing how many people – I just read an article. I think it was on Polygon. Somebody was like, this game is not fun. I don't enjoy it. I'm going to keep playing it for hundreds of hours. It's this strange thing of people going, I see there's potential in it. Everything I'm doing in it is not particularly good. The game is broken in a myriad ways. Things are frustrating, but – this is where we are with video games in a sense, where these games come out and they have lifespans, and this is just an early in the lifespan game. And maybe it will, you know, in the same way that Elder Scrolls Online came out to pan reviews, you know, people panning it and talking about how incomplete it seemed when it was released. Now it's this, you know, 4 or 5 years later, it's this very robust community with a, you know, tons of expansions and lots of content. It feels like a very cool game that a lot of people love. That's where video games
that's
are.
That's what I was going to ask. Don't you and Christian have games that you love that are like entirely broken and not even ones that got patched or better later, just like things that like are ostensibly bad games and then you love them and you're like, well, okay, I can't defend this elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess so. I struggle to think of any, but I guess I do. I kind of made a contract with myself just in the last month that I said I'm really just not – there are so many excellent experiences that are so big and deep, and I tend to leave them to go play the new hotness, mostly because I do the show and want to have experience with them. But I decided that I was going to follow my joy more strictly than I have in the past. And I have been very happy. I loaded up Fallout 76, and the first thing that happened, I got it on PC. The first thing that happened was it is a game that does not support ultra-wide monitors, which people listen to the show know I just got an ultra-wide monitor. And really from now on, every review of a PC game, I'm going to mention whether it supports ultra-wide or not because it changed my life.
I can't play this game in my pool. I have a very large swimming pool. It has an infinity line, yeah. And I can see Los Angeles burning on the other side of it. But like,
Brock, you look
I can't see.
You look there are four moments that define Jeff Cannata: the birth of his two children, him getting married, and then above all of those is him getting an ultra wide monitor. There's four.
Well, I recognize how obnoxious it sounds, but it's a new game in 2018 that doesn't support ultra wide. It's really weird. And it's not that it just has bars on either side. That would be fine. It's like broken. It's offset all the way to the left of the screen. And even when you select full screen mode, it like leaves up whatever was on your desktop on the right. So it is bonkers and weird. Like no other game, even games that don't support ultrawide don't do that. So it was distracting and weird and frustrating. And I got in, I wasn't really having much fun. And I went, you know what? I'm just going to set this aside. Maybe this game in a few months after some patches will be really have a cool community. Maybe it'll figure out what it wants to be and I can come back to it. But I'm just going to go play Assassin's Creed Odyssey because that's what I want to finish and that's what I'm in love with and that's what I'm having the most best time with. I'm just going to wait. So I have a very uninformed opinion about that based on very short amount of time with the game. But boy, have I read a lot of people that are just like, I'm going to stick with it, even though it is not fun and not, it's hard. And I don't know kind of why we do that to ourselves as a hobby. I think a lot of people do that where it's like, I guess I have to play this now because it's a Fallout game. I don't know.
Well, we have built our own goddamn nightmare cage here, which the only time I've stepped back from this in the last year was when the new David Cage came out. And everyone was like, hey, if you buy this, you are actively funding a guy attacking journalists to prevent abuse stories being covered. And I was like, that $60 is not worth it for the 3 to 5 days that this game is going to be something you can participate in games Twitter.
Yeah.
And like, I took that half to heart. And then like 7 days later, when I did not see a single tweet about the game, I was like, oh, God. It's true. Like our lifespan for like talking about these things, like Fallout 76, maybe because it is, as we identified earlier in the Game Awards segment, an ongoing game, which is a different weird category to put games in. Like, it's okay if this game doesn't work right now. It's ongoing. In 3 years, come give it a review score. Right. It is weird the number of games now that like, if you don't get them at the moment of release, you'll never talk about them or play them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say that the game is gorgeous. I think it's proof that a Fallout game can look great on modern systems. Like they really did a lot of work with the lighting systems in that engine, and it's really pretty. As you mentioned, it's a version of Fallout that isn't just browns and greens and grays. It's still a lot of that, but it also feels a little more vibrant than the last couple of Fallout games.
Did you think a little bit that they looked at The Witcher 3 and were like, we should do that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We should add a little, I don't know, color and lighting to our game. That's pretty cool. You can do that and have a gritty, dark game. Okay, cool. I don't know. There's, I guess, some positives. It just, I wasn't having fun. And I was super distracted. And I heard that there would be a patch where it would support Ultra Ride coming. So I'm like, I'm just gonna wait. I'm just gonna wait. And I'm not going to feel embarrassed about saying I'm just going to wait a little while. I know some people really love it. And it sounds like you actually are enjoying it in a perverse way yourself. So there's something there. But I don't know.
Every major like game site right now, like Polygon and Kotaku and stuff, should have a reviewer whose only job is to start playing these games 6 months after release when all the patches are there, when some new DLC is in there, and just be like, oh, hey, what's the actual like long-term version of this game looking like?
Right. Yeah. No, it's somewhere there's a review of Fallout of Fortnite where people are like, man, this wave shooter is this is gonna have no legs on this thing. Nobody's gonna play this. You know? So
I thought I came here to build a house. What's happening?
Yeah. We talked about that for a while, and you said you would even have things that you were more excited to talk about. So what else is on your playlist?
Oh, so 2 weeks ago, I knocked out Call of Cthulhu, the brand new 2018 game, which it has been a while since, even though I review a lot of games, my reviews almost always come out like a week later than everyone else's because I'm not at the biggest site. And also right now, the video games world, like you get your review codes like the night before it comes out. At Paste, we got Red Dead 2 like 48 hours before the embargo was up and it released publicly. Mm. And Garrett from our site did the only thing he could do with that, which was to write a review of the different horse hairstyles you could pick for your starting horse. And he goddamn committed to it. It's like a 2,000 word piece with like inlinking and like images and stuff. It's like, okay, so you did it. You did the most best middle finger thing that you could do to Rockstar on this thing. So I got Call of Cthulhu. I had about like a week to like check it out before embargo was up. But this is the first time in a while that my embargo has been up at the same time as everybody else. So I didn't know anyone else that was reviewing it. I was sort of like, I think I like this. And it turns out I liked it a lot more than other people, which is a weird place to be in where you're like, big thumbs up in the air, and everyone else is like, this is garbage to be burned and forgotten. For like a day or two, I sat around and was like, am I wrong? Am I bad at video game thought? Do I not do this right? I've come back around and was like, no, I'm right. Call of Cthulhu is a really good adaptation of a bunch of racist nonsense from an old dead guy. And it does the best that it can with that stuff. And it makes a really interesting, compelling game out of it that changes what kind of game it is. And it adapts a board game very well with all of its same rules. And you always understand what's happening, and it's sort of streamlined. And on top of it, it brings this mythos together in an interesting and fun way. And at the end of the day, like, maybe I just have so many friends that are too deep in like the, I write like Lovecraft fan fiction world. They're like, these are my problems with it. And it's like, okay, yeah, you're right. It wasn't racist enough. I guess that is a problem. I enjoyed it. It's a weird nightmare thing. And the best and most interesting part about it is that it is actually much like Arkham Asylum realizing, oh, Batman is the detective and he should solve a mystery. This sets you out over the course of solving a mystery. But the more information you gain, the more insane you become, because it opens up your mind to the terrible truths of the universe. So you have to sort of figure out like how, like there's an amount of the mystery you need to solve the mystery. But if you learn too much, you become a monster and travel to another dimension and everyone on Earth dies. So like it's a weird balancing act that you don't really know what the game is until it's too late. And then you're trying to like really spin the plates and figure out where to go there. And I was just like, this is cool. And there are little asides throughout that are based on other Lovecraft stories. And sort of my summary of it was like, it takes some of the lesser Lovecraft stories and makes them basically mini bosses in a game that doesn't have mini bosses. Because it's mostly like point and click adventure. And I was like, it's wild. It's out of control. I have no idea who put this together and decided like chapter by chapter, these are the 9 different games that exist here. And it cuts up the play in an interesting way. Anyway, on top of that, I just love playing Red Faction right now. Red Faction, the remastered edition, is so much fun, and I pull it up constantly every day, all of the time. You should too if you haven't played it.
It's a game that I adore. It's one of those ones that I can't believe got a remastered because
It didn't. Whenever,
you got a remaster. I understand.
Yeah, come on, get it right.
Thank you, Christian, for sticking to your game.
I adored that game when it came out. I don't think it got enough attention when it came out. And it's a truly delightful experience to just smash things just with a hammer. Just smash them, blow them up. And how
it is. It is also a game about like being overrun by an imperialist government, and you're like, no, you don't control us, and you control us from a distance, and we have to fight back. And I was playing it over 4th of July weekend, and one morning I woke up and was like, somebody should make a game that echoes America's independence, sort of like some sort of thing where we like shake off the shackles of something. And I realized, oh, for the last week I've been playing this game that is that, but on Mars.
Right?
I am the dumbest man who has ever lived, and I should die. It's like, oh, it's right there. I love it so much.
I also, you know, I downloaded this week because I think it was free on PlayStation Network. It was a free download game. I downloaded Bulletstorm Remastered, which has its own weird remastered name that I can't remember. Like, I don't know, White Knuckle Edition or something stupid. And Bulletstorm was another game that at the time I reviewed.
No. Keep guessing.
Bulletstorm, crapping bullets.
It's going to be like fully cocked or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Full of holes edition or something. I don't know. It's a game that I, despite myself, I really enjoyed when it came out because the
it's so good.
The tenor of it is not something that I usually respond to. It's very bro-y and weird. And the humor is a little clumsy and you know, oafish. But man, is it fun! The mechanics of the just sort of chaos and the maestro of death that you become on the battlefield, just knocking people around and flinging them. And you have this whip thing, that this tether that you can – it's a blast. So I was like, I'm going to re-download this and see how well the remaster feels and looks and see if I remember it, if it's as fun as I remember it. Well, it's still very fun. But boy, that – and Red Faction to a certain extent too – remind me how far we've come in a very short time with video games, because the storytelling is so poor. The stock characters that we get, I mean, if you look at something like Dead Redemption 2 and the Assassin's Creeds and Spider-Man, I mean, everything that comes out now, it seems, has decent storytelling, nuance. All the characters don't look like the same dark-haired, grizzled, stocky, muscular moron. It's a weird thing to think that that's how all video games were very, very few years ago. You know, every single game had the same bland, featureless dude as the main character, and now we have all of these really interesting, nuanced worlds that are created, and I was struck by that, because Bulletstorm still mechanically is a lot of fun, and Red Faction also, but man, both of those games feature completely unmemorable main characters and storylines for the most part. So I thought that was interesting. Christian, before we get to Christian, I want to thank our second sponsor. We got to thank our sponsor, Robinhood. You talk about video games. I've always thought that because I'm a video gamer, I might be good at investing. I might be good at playing the stock market, because it's kind of like a video game. It's kind of like a board game or a video game. And I've always thought, man, it would be awesome to give it a try. But I've been so intimidated by it, and I didn't know where to start. And I knew it was super expensive. If you play it like a video game and you do all these trades, it tends to be the case that you spend money every trade, like up to $10 per trade. Well, Robinhood exists to change all that. It exists to make investing accessible to people like me that didn't think it was for them, that were intimidated by it, that want to try it. It comes with easy to understand charts, market data. You can place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone, and they have no commission fees for trades. So you trade stocks, you keep all of your profits. They don't have a per trade fee. It's no commission. You learn by doing. You can invest as you and learn about it as you build your portfolio. You can discover new stocks and track your favorite companies with a news feed that's personalized in the app. It gamifies it. And again, you know, this is real money, so you got to be careful, but it feels so much more accessible. I'm actually enjoying the process of learning about it now. And because you listen to this show, you have an opportunity that's pretty darn cool. Robinhood is giving listeners of DLC a free stock, like Apple or Ford or Sprint, to help build your portfolio. You can sign up at dlcpodcast.robinhood.com. That's dlcpodcast.robinhood.com. Check it out. This might be for you. This may be the way to get into investing and building for your future.
I got into Robinhood because of their ads on a different podcast. And a thing that they didn't mention in your ad copy is that you can search for companies that have a female CEO and invest just in those. And that feels really goddamn cool to do.
That's awesome. I did not know that. No, I wasn't aware of that. That's super neat.
That's what I've done.
Very, very cool. I appreciate you mentioning that. That's awesome. Christian, what is your what is on your play? Oh, you've been playing the other big video game release this week. Pokemon. The new Pokemon is out, right?
Yeah, I've got.
Oh, dang.
I've got Pokemon to talk about and Hitman 2 to talk about. Should we start with Pokemon?
I think so. I think we'll give the people what they want, the Pokemons.
All right, let's go. Get it? Anyway.
Let's go, Eevee.
I've been playing Pokemon Let's Go Eevee. I got it with the Poke Plus ball controller thing because I'm an idiot with my money. And this game is delightful. It is gorgeous, which I think if you've seen videos of, you've probably been able to see. Capture the way that they recreated the very first Pokemon again in first in full 3D, and way Nintendo has been doing it, I think really since the Wii U, maybe even before, but utilizing their art direction and colors to their strengths to overshadow the underpowered system that they might be on. And I think Pokemon Let's Go does that so well with how beautiful and bright and stylized this world is rendered, and seeing it in, you know, HD graphics for the first time. We've had like Pokemon Snap and other Pokemon games that have had great Pokemon graphics, but still coming from, you know, what an OG Game Boy Color, and then seeing the world you remember from your youth in HD on your big screen, or even in handheld mode. It's really cool. But I think even nostalgia aside, I think this is a great entry point for new Pokemon players as well. I've been playing with my daughters, mostly watching. My six-year-old has, you can grab the second controller and shake it and kind of immediately jump in. And she's jumped in a little bit, but mostly enjoys just watching and hanging out and learning about all the different Pokemon. We'll spend time in the menus just reading about their strengths and watching their attack animations and all those things that Pokemon has always had. But having it be on the big screen for my kids to be sitting next to me is a really big deal. Whereas like sitting on my 3DS, you know, playing Pokemon that way, it's not as inviting to bring other people in. The biggest changes to this game from the mainline Pokemon series, and in my experience as someone who's liked Pokemon but hasn't played every iteration ever that's come out, it's the idea that battles in the overworld are no longer random. You don't have random encounters with Pokemon. You see all of the Pokemon that you can capture wandering on the map, so you can choose to avoid a Pikachu if you don't feel like capturing at them or whatever, right? Or you can seek certain things out and run into them and get them. Then the way you capture has also been changed. It's very much a Pokemon Go, the mobile game mechanic now, versus the traditional Pokemon where you'd be wandering through the grass, you'd have a random encounter, then you'd have to do a little battle to weaken them, or then you could throw your Pokeball to capture them. Now you go into battle, they're there, and you're just throwing your Pokeballs at them. You can do this. This is a game kind of like Mario Party, where you cannot use a pro controller. You are either using a Joy-Con or the Pokeball. And you can play in handheld mode. And in that mode, the default is you kind of move the console around to aim your throw and then hit A. You can turn off motion control if you just want a traditional analog stick and aim. But if you're playing on the screen, you use your Joy-Con or the Pokeball and you do a little throw. And you throw your Pokeball at the Pokemon to capture it. And you can, instead of battling it to wear it down, you can throw food at it, and that will improve your chance of catching a difficult-to-obtain Pokemon. And then your throw actually matters, too. Like, I'm surprised by how well it seems to track. And when I mess up, I know it's because I'm holding my 3.5-year-old and she's wiggling. And I'm not going to throw a perfect strike in that moment. But I understand.
I want to challenge you a little bit on that. You really feel that way? You really think that there's skill in the Pokeball controller? I'm not saying there isn't. I just find it hard to believe.
Yes, I'm not throwing a backdoor cutter to a Major League Baseball player, but yes, I'm very surprised because the Switch does not have like the sensor bar. It's all built into the Joy-Con or the Pokeball itself. And you do need to keep your arm straight and throw straight at the screen. If you sidearm it or break your wrist early, you will miss. Like it does.
Is it the kind of thing that once you've got it down, it will always, you'll always be good at it? You'll always be able to repeat that thing? Or is it,
yes,
vary from Pokemon to Pokemon? Or
so the throwing motion, yes. Once you get the motion down and you learn like the specifics of, you know, your arm angle or how you're throwing the thing. Like I said, this isn't a real-time baseball tracker. But how it adds difficulty to catching Pokemon is the circle within the circle will be a different color. So if it's green, you have a pretty good chance of catching that with any throw. If it's, I think it goes yellow, orange, red, maybe. Don't quote me on these colors. But the circle color is different, and you know that, okay, I need to throw it some berries to make it a little more easily caught, more receptive to me throwing a Pokeball at it, using a giant ball. So there's that thing. And then the Pokemon itself is animated sitting there. So Pidgey will fly, and it's like, a one beat, two beat, then it flutters up. So if you throw when it flutters up, you miss. And then that pattern isn't consistent all the time. So they'll juke and dodge and stuff like that. So you need to pay attention to the pattern. But it's not meant to be super complicated, right? Like this is sure. a stepped down version of the Pokemon experience. And it's playing off the popularity of Pokemon Go, where that too, when you flick the screen, like if you drag your finger to the right, you'll miss a throw. But also it's not skill based, right? There aren't like esports Pokemon Go ball Pokeball flickers out there, right? Like it's not that competitive.
Yeah, but does it, if it feels additive, it feels like this is a better way to play, or does it feel like a silly thing that you're doing over and over and over?
Both. And I think depending on your mind.
That was a really good sigh. That really summed up your review of the game.
Well, so I really enjoy this game. And so here's what the sigh represents this, Brock, who, by the way, my daughter and I kicked your butt yesterday. No big deal. Taking down the first
on
gym.
What?
In Pokemon. Yeah. You were a real pushover.
Oh.
We were way OP by the time we got there. Here's the sigh. Here's the sigh. It does feel very repetitive. And if you're out just trying to grind your Pokemon and you're running into all these Pokemon over and over and over again, and then throwing the thing and capturing, throwing the thing, capturing, throwing the thing, capturing, you're like, oh man, I am just doing the same thing over and over and over again. And look how trite and rote this is. But at the same time, that's the same thing you were doing before. You just had a little game of rock, paper, scissors before. So it actually took longer to accomplish the same thing. Like the point of why you're out there doing it is either A, to build your Pokedex, or B, to level up your Pokemon through experience of having them in your party in this game and before battling with them to level up their stats. And so I don't know if having it just be a simple throw mechanic or throw a couple of berries and then throw your Pokeball at it is a worse experience than running into their 800th thing and going quick strike, peck, dust, quick strike.
Well, are we going to have like a whole generation of kids needing Tommy John surgery? Is that what's going
to We already have that. That's called Major League Baseball. Like I said, it's not that robust. The other big change, though, in terms of simplifying it, is you have your bag of Pokemon with you at all times. So you don't need to go back to the Pokemon Center. Is that what it's in game? My terminology. The diehards I'll anger at some point, I'm sure, if I haven't already. But you have it with you at all times, so you're able to constantly change your party in and out. And everybody in your party, your six Pokemon, get XP as you battle and catch Pokemon in the world. And so you're really encouraged, I feel encouraged, to be constantly changing out what Pokemon I have and get all of them up to a high level. Whereas before, it was cumbersome to go back to get your bag to change Pokemon, where you kind of land on the ones you want to use and that you've leveled up, and then that's your crew that you have running with you. And I feel like this is a lot. There is the game here. We're taking down the gyms and you're going through this world, and there is that Pokemon game and little side missions of collecting X number of Pokemon or whatever. But I also feel like it is a like an auto vista where you're looking at all of them. You're seeing them in HD graphics, and you're meant to spend time with them in the viewer and change them out and get to know them, where it's like a real Pokemon game and Pokemon Snap, right? Where Pokemon Snap was just looking at your Pokemon in 3D graphics on your TV and there was nothing else to do. And this is that aspect of it, or walking around your car in Forza, but also going out and playing against other trainers and gym leaders. And it is simplified, but it is really enjoyable. And it's replaced Diablo 3 as my pick up and play for 20 minutes, just grind out a couple of XP for a little bit. I don't have anything else to do, or I'm waiting somewhere. And
do you play with the ball when you're waiting somewhere?
When I'm waiting somewhere, I play it in handheld mode, and you move the screen around.
I just want this idea of you like waiting in line at the post office or something, and you like pull out your little ball,
flip the kickstand, and then get the Pokeball out. Yeah, I'll bring the Pokeball. You'll see. It's, I mean, you played with that at E3.
I did. I saw it at E3. It's much smaller than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it's tiny, and it's not. You can't push Y. Like, you still need to use the Joy-Con to kind of get things started and to actually get into some of the deeper menus. And it's definitely meant as an accessory for this game, but you know, it's cute when like the you catch a Pokemon, you the Pokeball rumbles and it makes the Pokemon's noise from the ball, and my kids get a real kick out of that as like their first experience with Pokemon, and I get a kick out of it because I'm old and it's bringing me back to 20 years ago or whatever when I first played Pokemon. I think there's a lot to like in this game. I think it's easy to dismiss as like not a mainline Pokemon game and be angry that the Pokemon company didn't give us a real Pokemon RPG on Switch yet. But I think if you can look,
what is a real Pokemon RPG?
It's more in depth. The rock
paper than this thing that makes you explore the actual world.
I mean, I think it's harder. This game, I've heard that when you get to the end, you actually need to make sure you stock up on some potions and some revives and stuff like that. But this game, I have not, there's not been a challenge yet in any way, shape, or form. Traditional Pokemon games, you can hit a challenge pretty quickly in your gym. You need to go grind a la an old school Final Fantasy game where you're out running the world. And I think not being able to see characters in the overworld makes it harder also, where now I can purposefully go seek out. I can go into a screen and see if there are any Pokemon that I want to catch there. And if not, I can leave and reload. I'm not wandering around, you know, through the grass hoping to get a random encounter with a poison type Pokemon that I'll want to go on my next adventure or whatever. So things like that. And then, like I said, going back, time saving things that I think some players found endearing about the other games, because you backtrack more, and because encounters are random, you're spending time in battles more, where here you can avoid them if you're at a good enough level and you're just trying to get to the gym. It's simplified. It's definitely simplified.
I know I'm going to alienate a lot of listeners when I say this, but I have not only never really played a Pokemon game. There are a lot of franchises that I look at from outside and I'm envious of. Like, it used to be Monster Hunter was like that, where I'm like, I never really got into Monster Hunter, but boy, I wish I could. And then Monster Hunter World came out and I had that experience this year. Never, ever have I ever heard anyone talk about Pokemon and I've gone, man, I wish I was into that game. There's nothing about those games that sound fun to me, but more power to everybody that loves them. I'm certainly not, don't want to take anything away from people that love it. It's just, I never got into it. I missed the boat on it when it was a big thing in my youth, and it just doesn't appeal to me in any way.
Yeah,
I think we need a German word for what this is. Back when I was writing on Carboni's TV show, I was like, we should have a segment that like people that like know that they've missed out
right
on a franchise try to explain what they think that franchise is. And I was like, I'll go first. I've never done a Final Fantasy, but I did watch the CGI Final Fantasy movie. That's it. That's all of my Final Fantasies. So quiz me on what Final Fantasy is, and I will give you the answers that I think best fit it. And like, as we were talking about that in the office, like everyone was like, yeah, by the way, like, I don't know what a Resident Evil is. I was like, oh my God, you lucky, beautiful, golden forest child. Good on you that you've never had to do that. But also, tell me what you think that looks like.
Right,
so I
right.
love that this is your version. Like, what does Jeff think Pokemon looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I know that you get something and they start as one thing, and you make through a lot of repetitive stuff, they turn into something else. But that's about as far as it goes. I played a little of Pokemon Go when it first exploded, and I was like, okay, fine. But I just, the aesthetic has never done anything for me. The aesthetic of those little pocket monsters, I have to, there's something about me that maybe is very shallow, but I have to be at least drawn to the look and feel of the world. And I just have never, ever looked at a Pokemon and gone, that's cool looking.
Yeah. And that won't change. I remember I tried to get you to play Sun and Moon. I think,
yeah.
What it boils down to, and this game is different, right? Pokemon Go, the mobile game, is just about collecting. And the thrill of filling a basket with all the possibilities you can fill it with. And then the gyms, and they add a little competition there. But the traditional mainline Pokemon games, it's like any other, I guess you would say JRPG more so than the air quote Western RPG. But it is random encounters, grinding levels to then go take down these bosses and rule the world. And the way you do that is your weapons are these pocket monsters. And the way that you level them up is through these using them in battle. So it's kind of the RPG version of you get more grip if you climb more, like your Eevee gets stronger if you use her in battle, and then she becomes battle tested, and then you get to customize your move set. You learn new moves, but to add a new move, you have to drop a move. And then the way that you fill up your world, instead of side missions, which there are some, but instead of looking at your Spider-Man map and being like, I did all these side missions, you look at your Pokedex and you're like, I caught them all. And so I think it's that collecting aspect with the JRPG that makes it interesting.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. To show you how uninterested I am in all of this, they literally added this system to World of Warcraft and it didn't get me to play it. Like, they literally have battle pets in World of Warcraft, and I've never touched that system in a game I love with an aesthetic I love. So, you know, I'm a lost cause, and there's nothing that doesn't mean anything about the games. I certainly can't take away from the games by any of that. It's just it's more of a personal thing.
Yeah.
All right. Then I guess, Jeff, I have to ask, do you love Ryan Reynolds as Pikachu?
I haven't watched the trailer, but everyone keeps
God
going
crazy. God damn it, man. You've really done well at this. That's incredible.
Yeah.
You have just like done a brick wall, like a oh my God. Well, okay, cool.
Sorry. Sorry. Let's talk about Hitman, because Christian, you've also been playing the new Hitman, right?
Yeah, Hitman 2, which I guess was last week, I think it came out.
That can't be right, because there's way more than two Hitman games.
Let's all sing the theme song together.
You can't hit a Hitman.
Hitman
2.
And there's definitely more than
down at the end.
There's definitely more than two Hitmans, so that can't be accurate.
This is the seek, Jeff. I apologize to our audience. Me talking about something that I love, Jeff actually hates, brings out snarky cynic Jeff.
I don't hate. There's no hate.
We have him left.
I think it's funny that it's called Hitman 2. It seems very problematic because I know Hitman games have been being made for 20 years.
And no other franchise has ever renamed themselves as they rebooted with awkward names, Tomb Raider.
Didn't call it Tomb Raider 2, though.
No, but which Tomb Raider is the second Tomb Raider?
The one with the Rise Shadow of something kind.
Rise of the Shadow.
That's
the
way clearer. Hitman 2 is the sequel to 2016's Hitman, which was originally released episodically as a rebooting of Agent 47, and a full collection, full version ended up coming out. This game went through some IP hell in terms of ownership and IO getting dropped and what happened to this game and who owns it. They bought it back and now it came out and it's a thing. And Hitman 2016, Doom 2016. 2016 was the year of games again, just like the name of the game. It's Doom
the year of
2016. It came out and was really loved. Once in Game of the Year Award.
I was playing XCOM 2.
Naming things is hard, I think, at some point. And Hitman 2 is more of the same. It is all one package, so it's not episodic. I think it's six levels. I've gone through three so far, not completing all of the stories or all of the possible ways to experience the world. But it is very much the same game as Hitman 2016. And so if you love that game, Hitman 2 is very easy to recommend. The story is still a little overwrought. It's a direct continuation of that game's story, like literally picks up right from where that game kind of left off. However,
they should probably call it Hitman 2 if it picks right up right after it left off.
I mean, that'd be a great idea. However, you do not need to have played Hitman 1 to play Hitman 2, because the story, it doesn't matter. It's not why you're playing.
He's trying to kill people. He needs to kill people, and they need to be dead, right?
Yes. And why you're playing this game is that every level is a beautiful 3D interactive puzzle that becomes richer and more engrossing every time you play it. Because as you play through things, it unlocks new areas where you can start or new weapons that you can spawn in. And it gives you challenges. Like, you're at its base, it's like, hey, you know, go push Jeff Cannata out this window or whatever, right? And like that's your target. That's what you need to do. And by doing that and escaping, you've succeeded. But there are all these what would have been, you know, maybe trophies in years past, and I'm sure some of them unlock trophies or achievements in this game as well. But other ways to like do it with have a battering ram push him out of a window, or set up this explosive device to push him out. Have someone else drunk who then walks by and bumps him and pushes him out of a window. Like do
it's
it
like in- trick shots, right?
Yes, yes, and all of this stuff is outlined in the game, showing you all of the different possibilities or ways that you can do it. And it's about being creative in these environments and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And the beauty of it is the chaos that can ensue. And as things come together, or understanding or learning the AI routines of how things happen and why they happen. And sometimes everything goes to your plan and it's the most beautiful thing. And other times things go so sideways and also ends up being an incredible, beautiful thing. Where in the second level, I was trying to take out an older male target. And in order to do so, I was going to try to get this other... So I should also say the story unfolds. You won't hear all of the story the first time you play through a level, likely, because you hear it up by eavesdropping on people's conversations. And that tells you little story beats. So the world also becomes richer as you play it. You don't need to... You won't be like, wait, why am I in Miami? It won't be that jarring if you don't play through it every which way you can, but you learn more about these characters, what they're into, why they're shady, why you are trying to kill them, or why they're trying to kill you, which I think is really cool also, and just picking these things up randomly. So I had learned that the guy I'm trying to kill was going to meet with this other person, and so I could go and take them down, take their clothes, put on their disguise, go to the meeting, get into the meeting room dressed as them, and when the person I'm supposed to assassinate comes in, they would recognize me, but it'd be too late. We'd be in a room alone together, and I'd be able to kill them, hide them, and then sneak out and just effortlessly walk out of this level. I'm trying to figure out how to get to this person who I've seen a long way away. I'm like, okay, that's the person I need to get to. I don't know their AI routine, so I'm not sure what they're doing or where they're going or why they're doing certain things. And characters will stop and like pour themselves coffee. So if I put rat poison in that coffee because I thought the target was going to go there and someone else drinks it, well, crap. You know, and then they'll find a body and they'll be like, oh, we found this. A tourist's body is dead because they drank rat poison. And then there's an alert for something unrelated. So I'm trying to get to this person. I can't quite figure out how to get to him through this office building. And I see they're there and they kind of keep moving and walking around to a different part of this office park area. And then as I'm going, I see this service. It's like a service hallway in a hotel or something like that, right? Where I'm like, okay, looking at my little mini map here, I think this will cut through and get me over there and take me around the corner. And I go through this service hallway and then turn right and I'm in a bathroom and my target's there. And I was just like, oh, I take out a machete, wham, just take the person out. I mean, this game is all about violence, which is I wrestle with. We've talked about it before on the show, but it's not grotesque in that moment in terms of its on-screen representation. But I take the person out, turn out the door, still have the machete in my hand, and there's a security guard that just is like, hey, what? And I'm just like, nothing. And now it's just this rat race of me trying to get out of this office building that I didn't know how to get around well enough to get to the person that I was trying to do it in a stealth manner. It's just beautiful chaos that all happened because of happenstance, right? Like stumbling into the scenario. And so few games do things like this anymore, where they set up all of these little pieces, these dominoes, and let them start just falling down different ways as a level progresses. And seeing people talk about Red Dead, how seeing all of those systems interact with each other. I think Hitman 2016 and Hitman 2 also have so many beautiful and wonderful systems working together that makes these levels so fun to get in and play and experience. My knock against the game.
I think what Christian is on is that we should do sort of a radio play version of different famous people playing through levels of Hitman.
Yes.
But we just do the sounds of all the people around them. Someone's like, hey, what are you doing here? And then somebody else in a different hallway. Trying to visualize that thing. Christian, the two things that I think everyone needs to know about this game right now are, first, can you tell people about the briefcase?
You mean where you get to smuggle counterfeit items in?
No. Have you seen the briefcase error?
No, I haven't had a briefcase error.
Oh my God. So the thing that was trending on Twitter yesterday.
The homing
was
briefcase?
Yeah, people were throwing briefcases and it was acting as a homing beacon where it would chase their targets around corners and just murder people. And like you could go anywhere and fire this briefcase and they haven't patched it yet. And people were like, don't patch it. That's what I want in a Hitman game is a briefcase. Hunts people like a ghost and murders them.
It's hilarious, dude. You got to watch it. It's you can throw a briefcase and hit someone and knock them out. Well, for whatever reason, if you throw a briefcase and the character that you're throwing it at, it like locks on and it's going to hit them. But if the character keeps walking on its pathing and like goes around the corner, the briefcase chases them and will hunt them down. It's pretty funny.
That is pretty funny.
And what are the special one-off like hit characters called?
Your targets?
Yeah, the ones that appear once, and if you mess it up, like
yes. Oh crap. It's not gonna come to me right now, but yes, I know what you're talking. It's like special events where it's like this person's in world now, and yeah.
They started it last season, and it was this idea that like every map you can get a character, they pop up once. If you don't get them, they'll never show up again, which is goddamn infuriating to a perfectionist like me. But so this one started with. The character that is in the first level of the new game is Sean Bean, the actor Sean Bean, playing Sean Bean. And people were like, oh my God, Sean Bean, the most murdered man in all of Hollywood. But then I saw other people bring up like, hey, do you know what the completion percentage is on people getting this thing like in their one shot? It's like nothing. Sean Bean is going to survive more in the Hitman universe than he has anywhere else, especially Silent Hill.
Good for Sean Bean. Finally, one for Sean Bean.
Yeah, but that's what's great about this game and these two games. I think the prior ones too, but it is aware of itself, right? Where it's like very self-serious at times, but also you don a chicken mascot suit to like walk through the backstage of a football game or whatever. Right? Like it's very or like you're like, okay, you need to go. You know, sabotage this car and you don't like put on an accent. You're still a bald dude with a tattoo on the back of your head, but you have like a romper on, like a mechanic's romper. And you're like, hello, I'm here to fix the car. Everyone else is like, all right, you can fix the car. You're clearly part of our team. And you're like, yes, I'm part of your team. And it's so
Christian,
silly.
That accent work was incredible.
Thank you. I'm trying to do the radio play for you. my knock against this game, which I think is an unfortunate knock, but I think it holds true for most people. I'd have a hard time recommending Hitman 2 if you haven't played Hitman 2016, not because of the story, but because Hitman 2016 is so incredibly cheap and maybe even free on Plus or Game Pass, I'm not sure, and it is incredible. Like, 2 is more of the same, and if you have played all of Hitman 2016 and are dying for more maps to play and these sandboxes to play in, then yes, by all means, rush out and get Hitman 2. But if you have not experienced Hitman 2016, do that and save $40.
Fair enough.
But it's phenomenal. They're so fun. They're so fun and so well made. I mean, aside from briefcases or whatever, but
sounds like that's adding to the fun.
Yeah.
Man, I mentioned earlier that I made this pact with myself to just kind of follow the fun a little, at least through the end of the year. And I absolutely adore Assassin's Creed Odyssey. I mean, I'm going to be talking about it a lot.
Good.
What's that?
Good. Just good. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, it's I just find myself loving every moment of it. And I'm not rushing through it. I want to finish it, but I'm just following my curiosity. And if something seems fun, I go do that. I found myself like found a cave with a cool predator animal in it. And I'm like, I'm just going to go take that down. It'll be fun to do. I have a quest to go steal something from a fort that's manned by, 30 dudes. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to slaughter all of them and take over this fort. Why not? Because I am liquid death in that game, and it is a blast. I found myself scaling the side of a cliff face to get up to the top of this area to kill the leader of this entire region of the map. Because if you can destabilize a region enough, you can kill the leader and then take part in this massive scale war that flips the sides between the Athenians and the Spartans. And so I'm like, I'm going to go take down this leader, scale this cliffside, which is awesome because you can scale any surface, like Breath of the Wild. You can scale any surface in a Assassin's Creed game. I go up there, I take on six of his cronies, murder him, and that raises my notoriety level to all of the mercenaries. They're named mercenaries in the game that you're kind of working your way up the mercenary ranks as well. And so these two mercenaries come after me, and because I'm post level 20 in that game, at level 20, you unlock the ability to fall from any height and not have any damage. You just become a god. I mean, the game literally says fall from any height like a god. And so I just do a run as they come at me. These two like high level mercenaries are after me. I just take a running leap off of this cliff face where this palace is at the top of this cliff. I take a running leap off the edge and just soar down and land with a thud on the ground. And the two mercenaries are at the top, just baffled and don't know where I went. And and I'm like, it's just not tethered to reality, but the game is gorgeous. Every area, I've never used photo mode in a game more than I have in this game, because every area I'm like, I gotta take a picture of this. This is stunning. I get cool items to level up. I'm gonna probably be talking about this game a lot as I move to complete it. I'm already over 30 hours into it, and I'm probably about halfway. I'm just doing fun stuff. I'm letting my curiosity take me. And what seems fun, I go do that. Am I going to hunt down a couple of mercenaries? I'm going to hunt down a couple of cult leaders. I'm going to take down a fort and all its people. I'm going to steal cool stuff. I'm going to investigate the bottom of a volcano. I had a fight last night. There are these like legendary animals in the game that you can – there's a whole quest line to take those down. And I fought a legendary lion in the center of this naturally made pit, like this valley between two mountains creates this natural pit, and you can't, like, it won't let you start the fight by shooting arrows from the top of it. I tried to like game the system and just like pick him off with my arrows, and like,
that's
no,
called
no, no,
hunting,
no.
Jeff, that's not gaming the system.
I tried to get in my helicopter with my, you know, my AR-15 and shoot wolves. So I leapt to the bottom of this pit, and I fought this lion, and it was like a 20-minute fight. It felt like something out of Dark Souls. 20-minute protracted marathon fight. My palms were sweaty throughout the whole thing, whittling him down. There were ads. Mom spaghetti. Yes. You get it. Okay. You get it.
Yeah, I get it.
I had one shot. I was not going to let it pass.
One opportunity.
And he's like spawning like lesser lions to come at me. The game is fun.
That's way funnier than anything else you said. Spawning lesser lions is such like a perfect like cellar door level beautiful like English phrase. Spawning lesser lions. It makes me feel good to say it.
It's true. Anyway, it's not the last time you hear me talk about Assassin's Creed Odyssey, because I'm committed to it. In fact, it made me reinstall Origins. I like reinstalled Origins on my PC because I was like, I think it supports ultra wide. I think it supports ultra wide. I'm playing Odyssey on my Xbox One X, but I'm like, I had Origins on my PC, and I think it supports ultra wide. I think I'm going to install it and see how it looks. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about that more over the coming weeks, because I'm just following the fun. I have turned over a new leaf, guys. I'm following the fun. I'm gonna finish this game, and I really love it. I think the characters are fun. I'm like, there's a whole like Socrates quest line where he kind of like gives you these cool morality plays and asks you these questions, like Zen Koan type questions that don't have any you know right or wrong answer. It's just like, how do you feel about? It's fun. It's pulpy, but it's fun. It's great. Anyway, okay. Let's thank our last sponsor. That's Cashfly. Calling all game developers, publishers, and e-game experts. E-game experts. That's what they went with. Are you taking advantage of a content delivery network to supercharge your game's experience? Whether you're looking to grow your current player base or launch a new game, trust CashFly's global Anycast network to provide the performance you need without sacrificing security. Get the benefits of a global content delivery infrastructure without having to worry about server crashes and download failures. Since 2009, CashFly's solid 100% uptime SLA allows our listeners to tune in to our shows every week fast and easy. Give your players the same great experience. Don't lose players to slow game downloads. CashFly guarantees the quickest data transfer possible for all your players, regardless of location or internet speed. With instant scaling, players don't experience lags or glitches when your game's traffic surges. Turn casual players into loyal fans with fast game downloads and a seamless gaming experience from NYC to Hong Kong with CashFly. Having a content delivery network supercharge your game doesn't have to be expensive. Your traffic changes throughout the year, but your CDN bill doesn't have to. Effortlessly scale as your game grows without worrying about high CDN bills with custom pricing plans from CashFly. Receive a free custom CDN plan tailored to your game's delivery needs. Offer ends soon. Learn more at dlc.cashfly.com. All right, guys. As I said, there's a big, long discussion about Red Dead Redemption 2 with Dave Chen coming up. So
sure.
the show is far from over, so stick around for that. But Brock Wilbur, thank you so much for being here. This has been such a blast.
Hey, man. Thank you guys so much.
we love it, and I would love to have you back. You make me laugh like few people do. I love it.
Oh, thanks, bud.
Tell people where they can follow you and your exploits online.
No, first, I want Christian to say nice things to me.
Fair. Oh, go ahead, Christian.
Your Pokemon gym was actually really much stronger than I thought. It was real hard.
You know, that's not me.
Wait, what?
Christian, huh? Buddy.
Hey, how about this? Can I say this? I was legit sad when you moved.
Oh, buddy. No. I'm still around.
I know.
Also doing God's work.
But it was just fun. My favorite thing about LA, and especially the LA comedy scene, is we're all garbage people, myself included.
Oh my God.
But it's so fun when you see people that you genuinely like that you just run into randomly, and I feel like I would see you a good amount. Part of that also is some venues that are no longer with us, but I miss you, that's all.
Oh, I appreciate that too. We lost some things. Jeff asked me to promote some things. Search iTunes for Brock Wilbur. I have a couple of things that are sort of fun. My wife and I have a podcast called Missouri Loves Company. It's about us moving out to the Midwest to take part in politics. And we have done pretty okay so far.
Awesome.
Doing Planned Parenthood things. And we got Sharice Davids elected, and we feel good about all that. I have an emo podcast with Terrence Wiggins. I have a dark Lovecraftian self-care podcast called Carrying Into the Void. Have a board game podcast coming out with Matthew Monagle that's just about board games that adapt video games or TV shows or movies. So we're starting with the Fallout board game, awesome. And hopefully very quickly moving into the board game for This War of Mine, which of all the goddamn games in the world that would have a board game component, a very bleak version of Bosnia as a video game having this. Oh my God. Okay. It's
have you
so
played
cool.
it yet? I've heard it's, yes. I've heard it is spectacular, but very depressing.
Oh my God. It's a nightmare. And then they're like, hey, we have a board game. And I found out about it the same day I found out that Bioshock Infinite has a board game. And I was just like, hey, what's going on in the video game board game space? Who's playing these games that they don't exactly love or even enjoy? And like, you know what? I want to take this with me to a local cafe, invite some strangers, and just see how they respond to the hellscape I inflict upon them.
Awesome. Oh, I love it.
You guys invited me to also give a recommendation for something that isn't like games related.
Well, we'll get there.
Okay, cool.
That's coming up in a second. Christian, how about you? What's going on this week?
If you're listening to this Monday, I'm doing a spot at Flappers in Burbank on Tuesday that I know about right now. Usually my LA spots are kind of booked that week of, but yeah, I'll be there Tuesday. And then I said that Play Games Be Nice t-shirt is back. So you can find that at Cotton Bureau and search for Play Games Be Nice. And the proceeds go to St. Jude, and they help kids fight and beat cancer. So check it out and, you know, look good, feel good.
Awesome. I have another podcast for you to listen to. It is about movies and TV shows. It's called the Slash Film Cast. You can find it at slashfilmcast.com. Yeah. Thanks. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And that's it. Let's get it. Oh, you can also email the show, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Don't forget to do that. We love getting your feedback, comments, questions, whatever, what have you. All right. Let's wrap the show up now with parting gifts. Brock, now is the time to give folks a suggestion of something to do during their week. What do you got?
I thought we'd just burn through the time, so I was trying to
rush out. No, it's fine. It's fine.
So you get one from me and one from my wife. The one from my wife is to watch Big Mouth on Netflix. There's two seasons right now. It's a very, very funny animated show. It is very much in line with what I think Clone High would be now, but it also serves teenage boys and girls equally, and it's really impressive. Mine is that my buddy Dave Holstein wrote a show on Showtime called Kidding, and it got Jim Carrey to come back to television. The whole first season is up now. It's been continued for a second season, and it's basically the idea of like, what happens if Mr. Rogers exists now, and like, everyone's heard that premise in some sort of way where they're like, yeah. And then when does he break bad? He doesn't. It is a show on a modern paid for TV network that's about like, hey, what if a good person struggles but still stays a good person and never becomes a real piece of crap? And the struggle of that is very interesting. But along the way, there's a lot of really insane episodes and really cool things, and it plumbs the depths of some stuff. And the sort of script that gets Jim Carrey to come back to TV after 20 years is worth your time.
I've been meaning to watch that show, and I haven't done it. I gotta do that. I'm very excited to watch it.
If it wasn't my friend's show, I would not have watched it. And I was like, why is that? What is happening? It is really, really worth your time.
So again, that is Kidding, and the other show he mentioned was Big Mouth.
Big Mouth.
Christian, do you have a parting gift?
I do. It's been recommended by a guest on the show before. I had not finished it then, so I wasn't able to chime in. But Daredevil Season 3, I know it didn't get as much love on the internet as the first two seasons, but I think, having just finished it, I think it was astounding. It does the Daredevil thing of having an episode with one very brutal, long, one-take fight that they all seem to need to have now by, like, episode four.
It's the law. It's Daredevil law.
Yeah, right. That's part of it. There's an episode called Karen that I thought was particularly powerful. Kingpin is incredible in it. I think if you've fallen off some of the Marvel Netflix shows, and you have read some of the so-so reviews about Daredevil, if you like seasons one and two, give it a chance. It's a slower burn than some of the other seasons, but I think it's well worth it.
That's Daredevil Season 3 on Netflix. We got a listener-suggested parting gift. This was sent into dlcfeedback@gmail.com. This comes from Dan from Birmingham in the UK. He says, hey, guys, love the show and the positivity you put out into the world. Just wanted to suggest a parting gift that I think is right up your alley. Netflix is Atypical. Is a wonderful series about an autistic teenager as he tries to enter the dating world. The show is lighthearted and full of positivity. The show handles autism in a very realistic and unique way, and it is one of the most heartwarming and funny shows I have seen in a long time. There are two seasons out there right now, and it's an easy recommend for anyone who needs reminding that the world can be a good place sometimes. Oh, that's great. Thanks, Dan. Again, that's Atypical on Netflix. My suggestion, my parting gift, is also a Netflix joint. This is the new Coen Brothers movie, Ballad of Buster Skaggs. Oh, gosh, I love it with my whole heart. This is – it feels like a season of television, but it's a movie. It's a series of short stories. The way I'd like to describe it is, you know how Black Mirror is – like the Twilight Zone, but for future tech, near future tech. Ballad of Buster Skaggs is Twilight Zone for the West. It's what if there was a series of Twilight Zone episodes that were just about the West. It is a series of short stories. It is at times fun and funny and over the top and violent, at other times harrowing and dark and brutal. It is quite an extremely, quite an exciting experience. And I really
were right about the production there in your guess. This was originally made as a 10 episode TV show.
And then is that true? Down.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
They shot it as a TV show and they edited it down to enter it into like a film festival for some reason. And then they're like, you know what? Let's just leave it as this.
I wish they had left it as a TV series. I would love to have it be more fleshed out, but I mean, all of them are amazing. It's really good.
It's great. And then to find out that you're like, oh, each one of those stories had another 30 minutes. You're like, yeah, give that to me. Give it to me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Wow. I did not know that. Interesting. Anyway, that's The Ballad of Buster Skaggs and is on Netflix right now as well. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC, although you got like 50 more minutes of talking about Red Dead if you want to hear that coming right up. It's a really excellent discussion, and Dave is quite articulate about it, and I hope you guys listen. Again, even if you don't want spoilers, there's a good 35 minutes of discussion before we get into any. So check that out coming right up. But we will be back next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place. I am joined now by my friend slash co-host slash film. Ha ha. See what I did there?
Nicely
done.
Dave
Chen. It's Dave Chen from the Slash Film Cast. Welcome to DLC, Dave.
It is such an honor to be here. And I am not only a participant in DLC, I'm also a fan.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Hopefully you guys all listen to the Slash Film Cast that Dave and I do together. This conversation came out of just sort of, I guess, some tweets. I read tweets of yours about having finished Red Dead Redemption 2, and I just kind of wanted to talk to my friend about his experience playing it. So here we are, and I have come to terms with the fact, I've made peace with the fact that I am not going to finish that game. maybe someday, but you know, as we have many discussions about this on our podcast, that I am very, very spoiler averse, and I try to avoid them as much as possible, more so with movies than video games. But Red Dead is one of those video games that is trying to tell a very nuanced, in-depth story and relies heavily on narrative. And so it is a game that I would usually stay far away from spoilers. But I feel like I'm very so curious as to what you're going to say about it and want to hear your in-depth views, that this is going to have lots of spoilers. I'm going to spoil myself on it. And it's also because I think it's going to be a long, long time before I ever see the end credits of this game. So here we are.
So spoilers for Red Dead Redemption 2 starting right now?
That's right. Spoilers for Red Dead Redemption 2. If you do not want to be spoiled, now's the time to turn off the podcast. But Dave, you finished the game. How many hours would you say it took you to finish the game?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. What I did was I broadcast most of my play sessions on Twitch, and then I could look back and see like how long the play sessions were. If I had to guess, I didn't do that for every play session, so I did it for a lot of them. If I had to guess, I would say like 20 to 30 hours is
really
probably.
That's short. So did you stick to like main quest?
Yes.
Kind of pushing through? Yeah, okay.
So let me offer a few caveats before I talk about Red Dead Redemption 2. First of all, I just want to say my objective, being a busy working professional, was to get through the game as quickly as possible, right? Like to like play the game, get through the plot, like enjoy the story as quickly as possible. So I didn't spend like 6 hours fishing. I didn't like hunt down the legendary Kodiak bear stuff. Like I didn't do any of that stuff. And so my play style was probably very different than a lot of people. And people who play differently or who enjoy different kinds of playstyles might have an extremely different opinion of the game than me. But that's what makes enjoying things so wonderful, Jeff, is we all have different opinions and we can learn from each other. Right?
This is like somebody that has been looking forward to eating cake all week and has saved up and it's been anticipating this cake for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then gets to the end of the week and then eats the cake as quickly as possible. Just scarfs it down, shoves it down their gullet.
That analogy would be correct if the cake took, you know, 30 to 40 hours to shove down your gullet.
Right. So let me ask you this question as another means of setup. Did you play the first Red Dead Redemption, and were you a fan of that game?
So I have to say, I did not play the first Red Dead Redemption.
Wow.
Which I've heard is an excellent game. I will say that after this game, I did go and watch all the cutscenes from Red Dead Redemption 1. Okay. Someone actually edited together like a 2-hour movie on YouTube of just Red Dead Redemption 1 cutscenes. Mm-hmm. So I did go and watch that because I was so engrossed by the story and these characters. And so I know what happens to John Marston. I know what happens to Dutch Vanderlyn. Did you play Red Dead Redemption 1, Jeff?
I did. I found that game to be problematic in a lot of ways, but incredibly rich narratively. And I think it has one of the best endings of a video game of all time.
Yeah. So between the two of us, we have played both Red Dead Redemption.
That's right.
We have the knowledge of one normal Red Dead Redemption fan.
That's why we're here together, Dave.
Yep.
Okay. So that brings us to Red Dead Redemption 2. You powered through it. What are your overall thoughts on the game before we sort of dig deep into spoilers and the actual story of this game?
So I thought the game was, in general, very enjoyable. I had read a lot of reviews about this game. Like, so just to give people a sense of how much gaming I do, in a given year, I probably play through 3 to 4 games tops, right? Mm-hmm. So I really need to kind of ration which games I'm going to allocate my time to, because I don't have that much time to play video games. And so whenever a game does come out, I do a lot of research on it. Like, I watch a bunch of video reviews. I read a bunch of reviews, and then kind of be like, okay, I'm ready to donate like 15 to 20 hours of my life to this, right? Like,
mm-hmm, right.
And so
listen
to the DLC podcast, like nonstop, put it on repeat, you know? and I actually did listen to your segments on Red Dead Redemption 2. And I was like, man, I wish there was more conversation about this game on your podcast, which is why I was like, please let me have a segment on your podcast talking about it.
Well, here we are.
And so where was I going with this?
So you play few games, you value those games.
Oh yeah, yeah. And so reading all the reviews, I thought this would be a game that I hated. Like, I thought, like, based on everything I read, this is a game I'm not going to enjoy, because let me describe some systems in the game, right? I mean, the game, I was listening to Jeff Gerstmann talk about it. He's like, this game sounds like it's drenched in systems. I mean, when you describe the game to people and you kind of try to convey the verisimilitude, it's like, okay, depending on how often you eat, you get like fat or skinny, and then that affects like how quickly you can move. You can bond with your horse, and you need to brush your horse. You need to take baths, or else you'll have a scent on you. People will react differently to you. When you go hunting, you know, you need to hunt to get food for you and your camp. And if you smell bad, like, the animals will smell your scent and you won't be able to hunt them. And all of that just sounded completely exhausting to me. Like, I have enough difficulty taking, you know, like bathing in my real life, like on a regular right. basis. I don't need a game where I'm failing at doing that as well.
You Video know games saying? Are where you go to not bathe.
Yeah, that's right. By definition, I'm not bathing when I'm playing a video game.
Right.
And so I thought, okay, this is just not the game for me. And that's too bad, because I was like really excited, because this is a game Rockstar has been working on for many years. And so I was really looking forward to it. Then I read a bunch of reviews, and it seemed like not a game for me. But then somebody basically got it for me as a gift. And so I thought, you know what, I'll dip my toe in, give it a shot. You know, 1 week later, I've beat the entire game, right? because I just found the storyline to be so engrossing. Like, the voice acting is extremely good. It conveys this like air of authenticity that I found to be very convincing. And the systems overall, you can ignore them. Like, you don't need to actually bathe that much if you don't want to. You don't actually need to do that much hunting if you don't want to. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Over time, the systems kind of melt away. And you only need to do them as much as you want to do them. So for instance, like there is a system of like, if you're not wearing the right clothes, like if you're, if it's a winter environment and you're wearing like a light shirt, your health is like impacted by that. Your stamina and your health is impacted. But you can still do the mission. You know what I mean? It just means that it's like a suboptimal way to do the mission. It's not like they won't let you do the mission if you're dressed wrong, right?
Right. So what you're saying is that if your goal is to just see the story in this game, you can largely ignore a lot of the other stuff and just do that.
That is my assessment of it, yes. Yeah. And you know, some people might find that to be not enjoyable, or that might be people who like 100% a game might find that to be really upsetting, me saying that. But you know, for me, that's how the game worked. So I'll say like the story was really, really well done. The game is beautiful, of course. Like technically, it's a marvel. And there's just the game world is so big, and loading times are pretty minimal overall. You know, like it's just amazing to have a game world this large where there's just not that much loading. I mean, when transitioning between events, like if you're setting up a camp or cooking food or whatever, that takes a while. But like if you're just riding from place to place, like I barely perceived any loading between locations. And so I just think technically the game looks and feels pretty amazing. Right.
No, there's no argument there. It is an extraordinary technological achievement by every measure.
So let me turn around to you, Jeff, for a second and ask you, like, what is the point at which you kind of jumped off the game? Like, was there a moment when you thought to yourself, I'm done with it? Was it when you fell asleep while holding the X button? Like, what happened? You know?
No, that I persevered through. I honestly made a decision to try to do what it sounds like you did, which is I said, I loved the story of Red Dead Redemption. I thoroughly enjoyed that game, and I had to force myself to power through sections. There's a large section in Mexico in the sort of last third of that game that is just very tedious, and it feels like the game was crescendoing, and then it's like, nope, you still have like five more hours of story in this weird place that you didn't really even need to go to. Anyway, so I had to force myself to power through that game, and it was worth it. I got to the end, and I just found the ending of that game to be an emotional wallop and really satisfying in a way video games rarely are. And so I said to myself, I'm just going to do what it sounds like you did, Dave, which is just go from main quest to main quest, power through, see the story, do as little other stuff that I find tedious as possible, and just head down and eat my vegetables, you know? And so I literally completed a quest, got on my horse from my camp after slowly meandering through my camp, got on my horse and just like, I'm going to head to the next mission objective. Left the camp, went down a rise, four outlaws came out of the woods and one shotted me off my horse. And I went, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that definitely happened to me a couple times where you're just riding away, like there's like a bounty on you, you know, or something. You're riding out of camp and then you're just ambushed by a bunch of rival gang people or law people. And they just one shot you or not one shot me, but like, you know, they would kill me in like 10 seconds. Right.
Yeah. And if I had something like Assassin's Creed Odyssey has, for example, which has a quick save in literally every menu has the quick save option. I wouldn't care. I'd be like, oh, I'll just reload where I was and try to avoid those outlaws. But no, like Rockstar's decided that's not how they want you to engage in that world. And it just doesn't feel good to me. And again, I understand that's kind of immature and a lot of people probably will judge that decision. But for me, I just want to spend my time less frustrated and less taxed on sort of the tedium and enjoying myself more. And I get it. It's fine. I will also say, relating this to our usual topic of movies, I dated a girl in college whose parents wouldn't go see him. They once said to me, I recommended a movie. I can't even remember what it was. I recommended a movie that I just thought was amazing. And they went, you know what? We just kind of want to go and feel good at the movies. We just want to, you know, come out and like have a pleasant hour and a half in a dark place and then come out feeling happy. And I just thought that was such a small-minded response. I was just like, but movies can be so much more. And I want to feel. And I totally recognize I'm doing the exact same thing here with video games where I'm like, I just want to go in Assassin's Creed and have fun. But I recognize that there's more going on in Red Dead Redemption 2 and there it's a more ambitious thing and it's trying to make me feel different stuff. I just don't want to spend 30 to 50 hours doing that.
So I just want to say before we get into the next segment, whatever it is, that I really enjoyed the game and I wouldn't call it a masterpiece, but I would say it is one of the most ambitious games ever made. And it is something that I found to be hugely enjoyable. Like I look back on my time in Red Dead Redemption 2, and overall, I think it was a great experience.
Okay. So that being said,
I'm now going to spend a huge portion of time explaining everything I didn't like about the game. But before we get to that, I just need to make clear as possible that like overall, I really enjoyed it. I'd recommend it to people. You know what I mean? And I think
Chiefly because you were marveled by the technological prowess on display. And the storytelling
I thought was very, very strong. Now, I think, like, in particular, Arthur Morgan, played by Roger Clark, it's a great voice performance. And I don't think this character existed in Red Dead Redemption 1 for reasons I'm going to get to later. That's like a brand new character that's introduced to this universe, right? And so, like, they crafted that character out of nothing. He becomes a very memorable character. And really what you're seeing, in my opinion, is like you're seeing two forces at work, which is the kind of end of the outlaw period, right? Like the game sets it up at the beginning, like industrialization is making it so that people can't live off the grid anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And so you're seeing kind of that cultural force at work. That was obviously also a force in Red Dead Redemption 1. And then you're also seeing kind of how those macro forces exert a disintegrating effect on this Dutch Vanderlyn gang. Like you're seeing how this gang is being like chipped away at piece by piece over time. And I found those to be really fascinating dynamics that were depicted well in the game. So
I've always thought with Rockstar, though, that their storytelling is always ambitious, always sprawling, rarely not interesting, right? It's almost always interesting. But I think they have time and time again had a problem with pacing. And yeah. I wonder if that's the case here still, even as somebody that just sort of focused and went after the mainline story missions. Did you feel like the pace of the storytelling was problematic?
I did think it was problematic, and I'll get to that in a bit. I will say that this is the first Rockstar game since Grand Theft Auto 3, like the PlayStation 2 version, that I've completed the story, I think. Like, I've played Grand Theft Auto 4, I played Grand Theft Auto 5, didn't play Red Dead Redemption 1, but, like, I would always get to, you know, the 20-hour mark in those games, roughly, and just give up. Because I'd be like, I feel like this is taking way too long, and a lot of these worlds are like unpleasant to be in, you know, like if Grand Theft Auto 5, like, you know, everyone is like, it's very misanthropic. I would say that game is right. Like there's very few redeeming qualities to anyone in that game.
Their whole oeuvre is misanthropic.
Yeah. But I would say like this game, Red Dead Redemption 2, and I think probably Red Dead Redemption 1, like you actually root for these characters. You feel like the creators actually care about the characters, you know, like they actually are invested in the characters as well. They want you to like them. They want you to see them as noble, you know? And so I did not feel that with Grand Theft Auto 5. But I felt that with this game.
Think that the overall themes are a little nihilistic, you know, this feeling that whatever was magical about the West is dying.
I don't know about nihilism. I would say the one compelling kind of the thing that comes closest to that, I would say the game is very fatalistic, right? In the sense that once you are a person or you're a type of person, there are very few paths to redemption for you. And in the case of Arthur Morgan, so maybe we can start. I don't know. So there's like story things I want to talk about towards the end of the game. And there's also like aspects of the game that I thought were pretty frustrating, you know, like gameplay aspects. So which one would you like to discuss?
Well, I'll let you decide which would makes more sense to start with.
Well, let's just talk about like gameplay mechanics that I thought were pretty frustrating. And I'm probably going to make like a YouTube video about this. I've been thinking about how to approach it, but basically I think this game falls into the uncanny valley of video game realism.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is there are so many aspects of this game that try to immerse you into the reality of this world. Let me throw out a few aspects. Oh, I've already thrown out a few, right? Like when you take a bath, you need to scrub your head and your hands and your legs separately. You need to like press a button to scrub them separately. You know, when you cook, you need to like physically like move the food over the fire to cook it. When you hunt, if you don't shoot the animal in the right place, it ruins the pelt. When you skin the animal, it takes like moments to like do the animation skinning. And, you know, when you loot someone, as you pointed out in the podcast DLC, Jeff, you know, you need to do this whole looting animation.
Yeah.
Right. And that's just like a handful of the dozens and dozens of ways that the game is trying to say, hey, this is what it was actually like to do these things. You know, it takes time. It takes, you know, you got to take your time when you're looting someone. You can't just like press a button and like opens up the inventory and you can just auto add everything. Right? But the problem is it is a game. It is fundamentally a video game, and it will never achieve the, or not never, but like we are years away from achieving the kind of immersion that lets you really be someone in a game. And as a result, those moments of trying to make you feel like you're in the game ripped me out. Like it ripped me out of the reality of the game. And
you're fighting against the game at a certain point.
It reminded me that I'm playing a game. It didn't make me feel like, oh yeah, this is what it was actually like. It's like, because then there's like, it's juxtaposed with all these moments that are extremely ridiculous and silly, you know, that like, oh, I'm carrying like $10,000 on my person, you know, like,
right.
How is that working? You know, I can murder a person and just pay $100 and that's fine. You know, like it's the game is never going to be as realistic as what it was actually like. You know, it's trying to be Westworld. And it's not even achieving that level because it's a video game. And I really wish that it had to a greater degree embraced its status as a video game and understood that you don't need to force people into these extremely time consuming systems to make the point you're trying to make. You know, I don't think it needed to go as far as it did to make you understand what it was trying to say.
I want to make a point. I think you brought up a really pertinent thing and we kind of steamrolled over it a bit. And maybe this is unsurprising for people that know me, but I hope you'll indulge me a little. I think that I would love to see Rockstar make a VR game. I know that's not surprising, but
you want VR things, Jeff?
Because I think, honestly, you made this point, and I think it is worth underscoring. The problem with all of that is, wash your arms, wash your legs, wash your head. All of it is push a button. All of it's push a button.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, all of that stuff would be really compelling if you had a motion-type controller and you were literally scrubbing your arm and scrubbing your head and scrubbing your legs. And I know that still sounds tedious, but there is something about the interactions in VR that allow the entire thing to be slower, that allow smaller interactions – have much more meaning because you are actually physically doing the thing rather than abstracting it into press X to wash your head, press X to wash your arm, press X to wash your leg. And I find so often in this game, in what I've played of it, it is always just walk over here, push X, walk over there, push X, walk over this place, push X. And yes, I understand that's how video games work and all video games work that way to a certain extent. But in attempting what they're attempting, which you've outlined so beautifully, it lands much more in that uncanny valley because of the abstraction. If they could get closer to actually doing some of those things. When you brush your horse, you literally had to move your hand across, you know, a horse, right. And you kind of felt vibrations in the controller. I think those things actually would be more compelling and interesting, and it would immerse you more in that world, and it would make you feel like they're attempting to make you feel, which is what it would like to be a cowboy in the West.
Yeah, I don't know that that would be enough, like a VR version of this would be enough to get you out of the Uncanny Valley, but I can say that whatever they attempted here did not really work for me in terms of from an immersion standpoint. Like I felt, there's many times where this frustration pops up where, like, for instance, like you're going into camp, right? And you just need to you just want to make a little donation to the camp box. You just want to grab a soup and get the heck out of there, you know, to do the next mission. And the game forces you to walk through the camp in an extremely slow rate. And it's just like, well, that's really annoying. Like, I understand the game is trying to say to you, hey, if you were actually in this camp with all these people, you wouldn't just be running around like a madman.
Right.
But then, like, a bunch of other things, like, fracture the reality of the game. You know what I mean? So it's just like, I don't feel they struck the right balance between being ultra realistic and being a video game. I felt like they're trying to make a point by like making you press an extra button every time you wanted to like cock the gun.
Yeah.
And it ended up just reminding me that, oh, I'm sitting at home pressing buttons, playing a video game. Right. I think the game is also like, we talked about this earlier. The game is also really unforgiving, right? I mean, no pun intended, but like, you can be walking through town and you accidentally brush by someone on your horse. And you do it a little bit too fast, right? You're like, hey, I want to gallop a little faster to get to my next location. And you brush someone and then they're like, I'm reporting you for a crime. And then like people start shooting at you and then you start shooting at them to live. And then like now you're wanted for an even bigger crime, you know, like, and then It escalates out of control. And people are saying this, oh, and that's like a memorable 20-minute sequence of events. And it's like, yeah, but like I didn't want to do any of that.
Right.
You know, I just wanted to get from location A to location B. And so that's that could be frustrating where like, the game makes a choice where in this game you don't want to be wanted,
right?
Like in Grand Theft Auto, like that could be fun,
yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It could be like, oh, I got like military tanks coming after me. Like we're rolling over like Golden Gate Bridge or whatever the hell, military tanks. And that was fun to like escalate that and get 5 stars and stuff. And in this game, it's just a terrible experience. It's like you don't – like I never wanted it to happen. You lose honor, which I thought was like a very frustrating and inconsistent system. Like the game does a pretty bad job of communicating in general, in my opinion. But, you know
– Well, I think the response from people, if I may, is the game kind of actively doesn't want you to engage with it the way that you and I attempted to engage with it, which is – critical path, tell me the story, get me through it. It is pushing you to have those emergent experiences and pushing you to sort of just saunter through the valley during a sunset and maybe there's a rabbit that goes by and, oh, I should probably hunt that. I think it's trying to create a less focused experience.
Yeah, I know. I think that's true. Like it's wanting – it has in place mechanics – to prevent you from rushing through it.
Right.
Right. So in many ways, I did feel like I was fighting against the game. Right. And so, if you're not trying to rush through the game, if you're willing to take, you know, 60 to 70 hours playing the game, then you might have a much better time, right, than what I'm describing. Cause you're okay walking slowly through the camp. You're okay, walking from place to place in the city, you know, and so on. I will say, let me bring up a thing I really liked about the game is for a huge portion of the game, you are visiting these towns that like literally could be called one horse towns, right? Like that it's like 6 buildings that look like they would fall over if a stiff breeze blew on them.
Yeah.
And that's like the whole town. And then at some point, I would say probably at the around, you know, chapter 3, chapter 4 mark, you arrive at this place called Saint-Denis, which is kind of a like a New Orleans type stand-in that it's really incredible. Like it is like a whole city, and the visual contrast between what you have experienced up until that point for many hours Like, you're in the middle of nowhere. You have these cities, these kind of towns that are in the middle of nowhere. All of a sudden, this city springs up to life, and it's like, oh my gosh, like, this is the future. And I really loved how you as a gamer are kind of experiencing modernity along with the characters. You know, like, the character is also being like, oh my gosh, like, this extremely elaborate city with all these people that are dressed really nice. Like, you also are witnessing that because you spent 10 to 20 hours, you know, in extremely sparse environments. Right. It's really an amazing moment when you get to that point. So I to the game's credit, I did want to say, like, there are, but again, it kind of goes towards, like, character design, you know, and the engine and the world rather than, like, the actual game mechanics, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So those are some of the issues I had with, that's like the biggest issue I had with the game, you know, is that, like, I felt like I was fighting the mechanics the whole time. Shall we talk about the story?
Yes.
Shall we talk about, yes, like, where the story goes? So I think there, I haven't played Red Dead Redemption 1, but my sense is that chapter 5, I think, happens in a place called Guarma. Have you heard about this?
Yes.
So it seems like it's kind of similar, where you wash up on a beach in, I believe, Cuba, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you help to lead a uprising, yeah, uprising against, yeah, oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, you kind of get involved with Native Americans as well, also trying to lead an uprising against their oppressors. And I think, to me, the game was introducing a ton of new story threads and new characters at a time when it should have been trying to wrap things up.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you have characters you've never met coming in, like, chapter 5 and chapter 6. And I was already extremely engrossed by the story until that point. And all of a sudden, you're introducing me to all these new characters. You know, the way that the game handles those characters is competent. It's not terrible. But it just felt like it was stretching itself too thin and really, like, was being overly ambitious. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I think we both rather a game be too ambitious than not ambitious enough, right?
This is something that I think Rockstar has done over and over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, even L.A. Noire, it's like you finish the Black Dahlia storyline in that game and it feels like, man, that was incredible. I guess the credits are going to roll now. And it's like, no, now you got transferred to the arson division. And it's like, what? I don't – what? Yeah.
So I think if that was the only issue – then I would have, like, a much more positive impression of the game. But we got to talk about the epilogue, too.
Okay.
Before we get to the epilogue, we got to talk about what happens to Arthur Morgan, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any idea what you're about to say. But I will say that the first game, you know, earned its title of Red Dead Redemption as a really redemptive tale about a son redeeming the father, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I found it to be so beautiful and so powerful. Does this game earn the redemption title?
I think so. Mm. I would say yes. So you don't know what happened to Arthur Morgan. I'm going to be the one to pop your Arthur Morgan cherry.
Indeed.
On the podcast.
Yes.
This is a great responsibility. I don't think I've prepared enough for this. So essentially what happens through the course of this game is that the Dutch Vanderling gang continues to disintegrate, right? And the gang finds itself besieged to a greater extent and with more frequency by outside forces, whether they be like gangs or law people. And, you know, Arthur Morgan, your character, starts to be kind of a malcontent in the gang, right? He starts kind of saying, he starts doubting Dutch quite a bit and then voicing his discontent with regularity. And you basically become the wet blanket of the Dutch Vanderling gang, right? And you feel like the tension growing between these two characters. It feels like really unpleasant because I found Dutch Vanderling to be like a pretty charismatic guy in the earlier parts of the game. And then and you feel like this kind of bond between them. And then like that just starts going away. And like I really felt painful. It was painful when that started to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, essentially, there is a big conference. Like Dutch Vanderlyn starts, becoming more attached to this other character in the gang called Micah, who becomes Arthur Morgan's kind of rival. And Micah is like a terrible person and has done terrible things and is an unsavory character. And so the game ends, the Arthur Morgan storyline ends with a big confrontation between Micah, Arthur Morgan, and Dutch Vanderlyn. And essentially, like, Arthur Morgan tries to, tries to kill Micah and fails at doing so. I did want to backtrack a little bit and talk about game mechanics and say, like, one thing that I actually thought really worked in the game from a game mechanic perspective was the horse bonding perspective, the horse bonding stuff. Mm. Did you ever engage in any of that while you were playing?
Only a little bit.
So there is this beautiful moment at the end of the game where Arthur Morgan needs to leave his horse behind to like ascend this mountain in order to find Micah. And his horse like is shot or like is exhausted and drops to the ground. And Arthur Morgan says to his horse, like, he just says, like, thank you. He says to his horse, like, thank you. And then runs up the mountain. And it's just like, oh, what a beautiful point. What a beautiful moment. Because you spent, like, at that point in the game, I had spent, you know, many, many hours, like, riding on that horse. And I just really appreciated that. And apparently, if you get a new horse, like, right before you do that mission, that moment doesn't happen.
Wow.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
That's pretty amazing.
Anyway, Arthur Morgan runs up the mountain and encounters Micah, and basically they have this big fight, like a fist fight. You know, I didn't enjoy the hand-to-hand combat in this game particularly. Nor a lot of the, like, I thought the aiming and covering system was pretty rough overall. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely. I felt that about all dated. Rockstar games. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty dated. It doesn't feel like it's evolved at all.
Right. That's my problem is that they spend so much time evolving everything else and they do like, these core systems. They're anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have this like fist fight with Micah. And then Arthur Morgan, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, I'm like telling the story really poorly. Arthur Morgan, you find out like earlier in the game, has tuberculosis.
Oh, wow.
And so he's like already in a terrible state as he's like in an implausibly terrible state. Cause like, there's no way someone would like be able to do all the stuff he does with tuberculosis and coughing all the time. But anyway, he essentially like fights Micah.
He's the Doc Holliday.
Right, and he collapses at the top of the mountain, and Dutch Vanderlyn intervenes before Micah can finish off Arthur Morgan, and then kind of like he's seen kind of like walking away from Micah, like Dutch Vanderlyn intervenes, and then Arthur Morgan's left on the mountain, and then dies as the sun is coming up.
Wow!
Right, so he spent his time trying to stop Dutch Vanderlyn. Trying to stop Micah, who had gone on to do these unsavory things, and then dies at the top of the mountain in doing so. I'm sorry, I think I told that story pretty badly, but you know, hopefully you get the sense that like he was kind of a martyr. He sacrificed himself in order to kind of do the right thing, right? And that was the end of Arthur Morgan. I should point out that he also told other people, such as John Marston, like, get out of this gang, live your life, you know, and the gang kind of like disintegrates by that point in time. Right. So that's kind of the end of Arthur Morgan's story. And I was like, wow, that was incredible. And like this, the sun rising on Arthur Morgan's dead body as he like exhales his last, it's like a beautiful moment. And I've spent like, many hours playing Arthur Morgan, and then his character passes away and like has this kind of redemptive arc where he tries to save all these people from Dutch Vanderlyn in the gang. And it's great. And then the epilogue happens. Do you know anything about the epilogue?
No, I've heard a lot of negative things about it, but I have not heard what it is. And again, the first game's epilogue is, I think, one of the most beautiful things I've ever played in a video game. So the epilogue here, again, last game we had a dead character and then you play a new one. Do you play a new character in this epilogue?
That's correct. You play John Marston.
Oh, okay.
So John Marston has escaped the Dutch Vanderlyn gang at Arthur Morgan's behest. And then you start playing as John Marston. And I should point out, by the way, that like when Arthur Morgan died, it wasn't super clear that he was dead, like, because you know he stopped breathing, but maybe he was just resting, like, you know what I mean? Like games do this shit where they like, or do this stuff, I should say. Sorry, games do this stuff where they you think someone's dead, but then they come back later. Like, oh, I patched up the 18 bullet wounds, right? So I didn't know for a fact that Arthur Morgan was dead. It seemed like the game wanted me to understand that, but like I wasn't 100% sure. So then you play John Marston. You're escaping with your wife and son. And I thought, oh, what a nice little button that basically like Arthur Morgan has enabled the escape of these people from the gang. And you're now John Marston and you get to like have a nice little life, like a setup for the next game.
Next right? Slash like previous game.
you get your gang together and then or not your gang, your wife and your family together. And then Red Dead Redemption 1 happens. And I thought like, what a nice little like button on the end of the game, you know, a nice little like, it's cool. Nice little dessert.
Yeah,
you know,
sounds really cool that you would play the character that you have already played, and it's right, a prequel. Yeah, right. It sounds awesome.
It's great. The epilogue lasts 6 hours. Like if it was like a 30-minute epilogue, I'd be like, oh, what a delight, what a perfect way to end that game.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is a 6 hour. It is its own game unto itself.
Classic, right? Rockstar, man.
It is its own. Like you could release a game that is 6 hours long and sell for $30. You know, like yeah, that yeah. is its own game.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, it reminds me of something that our mutual friend Dan Trachtenberg once said about a film, which is like the epilogue takes a complete thought and makes it incomplete.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
It takes like what was a extremely satisfying story, and then it's like, hey, here's a whole bunch of other shit with this character that I'm sorry, there's no swearing on DLC, right? So here's a whole bunch of other stuff on this game that this other character who, yes, you might have played Red Dead Redemption 1 7 years ago, but that you are basically not invested in throughout the course of most of this story.
So is the biggest problem is that it overstays its welcome, or is
yes.
or, okay, and that's it, really the all. But is that what you're doing interesting?
Well, what you're doing is you're basically – you are literally shoveling manure. Like in this epilogue, you as John Marston, you're trying to go straight.
Right.
Right? So you join a farm and you're like, I'll work on this farm, sir. And you're literally shoveling manure. You're building fences.
Oh, my goodness. Press X to build fence. Press X to shovel manure.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly right. Not press X to shovel manure. Press X to – press, you know, square to pick up manure, walk over to the wheelbarrow, and put the manure into
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, my. And then –
congratulations on all this time you spent in this game. Now we get to do this. Yeah.
I know. It just – I felt like, oh, my gosh, what a complete satisfying story. And then this epilogue happened, and it's like its own complete story. It's basically the video game of equivalent of what some people in the industry in TV and film call a backdoor pilot. Right,
right, right.
It is like, right. here's a way we're going to sneak in a little John Marston prequel
yeah.
into the game for you.
Right.
And I found it to be like enormously frustrating. Now, I know some people that like you could like the game map opens up to you in a huge way during this section of the game. Like, it's basically a whole other, you know, 20 to 30% of the map that, like, you haven't experienced, like, happens in this part of the game.
Wow.
And for people who love that exploration, who love the fishing and the hunting and all that stuff, and just riding around, I think you'll really like the fact that it opens up that way. But for me, I wanted a really satisfying ending to this story. And it goes through a whole arc for this character. Jeff, like John Marston, like his wife leaves him because like the farm that you're working for becomes under attack. Yeah. And then John Marston is like, well, I gotta like take things into my own hands. And he, you know, gets out his gun and starts like killing people again. And the wife's like, I don't want to do this anymore. And then she leaves. And then like he has to try like get her back, you know, and it's a whole story right
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Right. And some people are listening to this right now and they're thinking, that's awesome. I want another story in my Red Dead Redemption 2. And if that's the case, all the power to you. I'm glad you really liked it. But for me, I wanted the story to end. You know, I wanted an ending to the story, and offhanded in a scene of dialogue, it's offhandedly disclosed that John Marston is dead. And oh, like a character that you met, like, oh, I buried him earlier. Like I found him and I buried
you
him.
You mean
and-
Arthur Morgan?
I'm sorry. Arthur Morgan. Like it's disclosed. Like the whole time I'm playing as John Marston, I'm thinking to myself, hey, is he going to meet Arthur Morgan? Like, did Arthur Morgan somehow miraculously survive that ordeal?
Right.
And he's going to meet him. And then he has a conversation with a character from earlier in the game where it's like, hey, I found John Marston and I found Arthur Morgan. I buried him.
Right.
And I'm like, oh my God. Like, I can't believe that is the way I found out that Arthur Morgan is dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's the, yeah, obviously it's very intentional, right? It's obviously like a Game of Thrones-esque, like we're dismissing, you know, the character's death like offhandedly. And that's what it's like in the West. You know, one day you're playing 30 hours as Arthur Morgan and the next minute you're being like you're a clip of dialogue between two characters, you know, like right. I get that that's what the game's trying to do, but I guess that's not what I wanted to have happen. Like, it's not what I thought the character deserved after the whole storyline that you went through with him.
Yeah.
So anyway, Jeff, I know I'm like overstaying my welcome on the DLC podcast right now. So like,
no, this is great.
I won't go on for much longer, but I'll just say that, yeah, like you basically go through this whole arc with John Marston that lasts 6 to 7 hours.
Yeah.
And if it was 1 hour, I'd be like, great, you know, awesome setup for the next game. Beautiful. But it's 6 to 7 hours. And it's just like, I've spent so much time investing in this Arthur Morgan character. And now you're making me play as a completely, you're like ripping me out of that like mental space. And making me play as this completely different character who, if I played Red Dead Redemption 1, I might care about. But still, like, that's just, I think it's bad storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, I just, it's you have an epilogue with a completely different person. So when I say all that, how does that sound to you? Like, does that sound appealing in any way? Like,
No.
Let me ask you this. The epilogue for the first game, right? Because you play as John Marston's son in the first game, right? How long did that last?
It's not long. I think it's not. Super short, but it's not 6 hours. It's like maybe an hour.
Like an hour, right? Or something like that.
Yeah. I'm going from my memory of it from years ago, but it didn't feel over long. It felt like this incredible moment when you sort of are him and then you have to do some stuff. Like, it's not just go pay respects to dad. Like, you play some game, but it's not an entirely new game like it sounds like this is.
Yeah, I mean, you basically become a farmhand. There's this episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Did you ever watch that show?
Oh, I love that show.
There's this episode where like Picard is on the ship, and then they find an alien probe, and then it like flashes a light at him, and then he like passes out, and then he finds himself on a different planet, and he lives an entire lifetime, right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I think the movie, I want to say it's Inner Light is the name of the episode.
Oh, man. I wouldn't know, but yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And so he lives an entire life. He lives decades of his life before like resuming as a captain on the ship. And it basically, they reminded me of that. It's like, I'm living an entire life in this epilogue.
Right, right.
This epilogue that should take like 30 to 60 minutes is an entire game.
I think it's an example of something you see again and again and again with Rockstar games. And we've talked about it both in the mechanics and in the storytelling. More isn't always more. More is sometimes less, you know? And I mean, luckily, that's not the case here with you and me, because we've gone like double the length that I thought we were going to go. But more in – he's actually more here. I've enjoyed it very much. But sometimes more is less, and I feel like they layer these systems on, and theoretically it's interesting, you know, in sort of an abstract way. It's interesting to live a simulated life of the West. But in how it plays out for me – in practice, it is not particularly compelling. And I think it sounds like the narrative is that way too. It's like, we're going to give you so much more at the end. That doesn't make it better.
I think the ending is just really bizarre. To be honest, the word that I felt was like bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, because so after you do the John Marston stuff, you do all the missions. The game basically is like, hey, now you own this farm. You own this farm that basically you were at the beginning of Red Dead Redemption 1. Or not at the beginning, but like Beecher's Hope is where your home was in Red Dead Redemption 1. So like, you literally build the house in the game. Like, it's an actual mini game of building the house that you live in Red Dead Redemption 1.
Right.
And then at the end of this whole epilogue, it's like, hey, now you own a farm. So you got to take care of the farm. Do whatever you want, you know, with the farm. And so you can theoretically continue playing. So it's essentially like New Game Plus.
Yeah.
but you're playing as a different character.
Right.
This would be like, you know, God of War, like you get to the end of the game and then like you restart the game and you're like the kid instead.
Yeah.
You know, like, or something. It's just like, it's weird. Like when I do New Game Plus or when I keep playing, I want to play as a character that I spent all this time investing in, you know, not a completely different character.
I mean, there's something really cool about that. There's something really cool that the game is this whole other game at the end. Like you completed the game and now a different game starts. I think that's, yeah, there's something kind of cool
about
it.
It's like ambitious. It's super ambitious. Like what you cannot deny is that this is the vision of a singular person or a very small group of people, yeah, right? Like you cannot deny that, like, there is authorial intention behind virtually every decision,
yeah,
right? So whatever they were trying for, they achieved it. Now, whether you like it or not, which I didn't, a lot of it, you know, a lot of the decisions, you can't deny that they didn't set out to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. And so bold move. What I can say to that, Jeff, is bold move.
Yeah.
Bold move to have a completely different game at the end of your
game.
Let me just say one last thing as I wrap up here, which is just that, like, I thought the characters overall were, like, extremely memorable, right? You got Dutch Vanderlyn, you got Abigail Roberts, who plays John Marston's wife, Sadie Adler, who is the first character that you rescue in the opening mission, right? Like, her whole family is massacred, right? And she becomes, like, a complete badass bounty hunter during the course of the game. Like that relation, that character, that relationship between Arthur Morgan, John Marston, Sadie Adler, that kept me coming back to the game. I was like, at my time of highest frustration, I was like, I want to know what happens to these characters, right? And so it's hard in movies to create characters that are memorable for a 90-minute period. It's even harder to do it for a 40-hour period. And I think the fact that the game did that, you know, with multiple characters, Arthur Morgan, Dutch Vanderlyn, I know he's a previous character, but, you know, a different version of that character, Sadie Adler, it's a huge accomplishment. And I don't want to deny that despite all my massive frustrations, the game is very special. And it is, in my opinion, is worth playing. But I totally understand anyone who does not want to play it.
Well, it's been an awesome conversation with you, Dave. I appreciate you spending the time and talking through it. It's awesome to be able to talk about video games like this. You know, I think we're seeing more and more of it. We are clearly in a period, the golden age of video games right now. I remember for much of my life, you just couldn't have these kind of discussions about video games. And it's amazing that the resources, time and energy and pure manpower was put to work making this. Like, this is, it's an extraordinary, I described it on the show as feeling like an indie game, but it's the most expensive game ever made, right? It has the indie spirit of really shooting for something, trying to do something different and interesting and challenging. So in that way, you can't help but applaud it.
Agreed, sir. Agreed.
Well, thanks. Tell people where they can follow you and all of your different creations online.
You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. And if you are not seething with rage after hearing me talk about Red Dead Redemption 2 and you want to hear more of the stuff that I do, the stuff that I'm interested in, subscribe to my newsletter at davechen.net/letters.
Awesome. And you can always listen to us talk more. Dave and I talk more on the /filmcast at /filmcast.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.